a second-by-second guide to keeping your audience up to date with the very latest changes.
This is Peter Porter reporting.
Our reporter Peter Porter there reporting live this morning. And we'll keep you up to date with the very latest developments as they happen. But now with the time at 16, and we interrupt this time check to go straight back now for a live report from our reporter Peter Porter. Peter, can you tell us what's happened in the last 12?
Well, yes, I've had about one sip of coffee and taken about three breaths.
Yes, it must be breathtaking stuff indeed.
Well, I can't confirm that at the moment, but it does look pretty much that way.
Peter, can you tell us what the atmosphere's like?
Well, it's about 80% nitrogen, 16% oxygen, 4% carbon.
Our reporter Peter Porter. Now news of the prime. And we interrupt this word to go straight back now live to our reporter, Peter Porter. Peter, can you tell us what's... Plus, handy hints on that absolute obligation to charge every dispatch with that atmospheric, in the thick of it, action dynamic. The Broadcast Journalist's Guide to Reporting the Demise of the Iron Curtain.
Friday, it's 5 o'clock, and welcome to BCFM's Politics Show. I'm Tony Gosling. Helping me review this week's news is Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers. From our People's Republic of Stokes Croft, Ministry of Propaganda Studios. In the second hour, the censorship is definitely the theme. The American Frontline Doctors press conference outside the US Capitol building is censored on Wednesday by YouTube, Twitter and Facebook, all at the same time, after receiving around 20 million views. So let's have a listen to their dangerous words. And also, Mohsin Saeed Abbas is a TV journalist who had his Facebook account suspended this week for comments about an Israeli army patrol attacking a disabled Palestinian man who was in a wheelchair. We'll speak to him about the mechanisms behind this kind of censorship. And 2 years ago, in the European Parliament, Bulgarian investigative journalist Diliana Gitancheva exposed a secret US military bioweapons program in Georgia and elsewhere around the world. But her questions were disallowed in the parliament, and then she was banned from the European Parliament building for asking questions of a US representative who was being quizzed there. Could she have uncovered a biowarfare conspiracy that we're now seeing unfold before our eyes? The censorship is coming into the open now, but what about in the past? Have basic ideas like creation or intelligent design been censored over the decades? Has the spiritual also been the target in a decades-long psychological warfare operation? Well, that's all in the second hour after six, but joining me to review this week's news is Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers. Hi, Martin.
Hello.
You're coughing a little bit there. You haven't got the COVID, have you, this week?
I hope not.
Good. Also, there was a bit more news this week about here in Bristol, particularly the problem with bins. So another article about this. Can you say something about the way that basic public services have been slowly denuded over the last, well, particularly since the 2008 financial crisis and the election of the Tories in 2010.
Well, local government has been denuded before that. It goes back to the 1980s. And it's partly financial and it's partly institutional. So they haven't got the powers they need to do the things they need to do.
Here in Bristol, we've got an arm's length company, they call it, that's been created. It's now, I believe, it's doing three or four different types of things, one of which is housing, another is Bristol Waste, and the other is Bristol Energy. Now, all three seem to be rather disastrous. We've had a massive overspend of hundreds of thousands of pounds by Bristol Waste, and we know something like £40 million been spent, good money, throwing good money after bad with Bristol Energy. So it doesn't really seem to be working, does it?
Well, I mean, you've got specific projects like that in Bristol, which there are specific questions about how well managed they have been.
Yeah, but there's all sorts of similar projects in other parts of the country.
Well, you've also got the basic problem of outsourcing, and you can see that in relation to the test and trace regime. In Germany and other countries, they've actually used their health infrastructure to carry out test and trace. The Tory government here has decided to hand it over to Serco and various other Capita and other, you know, generalised companies who basically don't even have skilled staff. They're just basically recruiting people who've got no background in that particular field, and then they're expecting them to, from scratch, create a system. And that's what's been going on for years. Basically, it destroys the lines of accountability. So, you know, when local councils ran things, you knew if something was wrong, you knew who to complain to. But you've now got basically jobs for the boys, contracting out, much of which is actually more inefficient than actually doing it in-house. But this is going to come to a head because the government's promised that it will support local authorities who are going to be undermined by the recession that's coming round the corner. But of course, local authorities have got to balance their books, as have the devolved governments in Scotland and Wales. And and Northern Ireland, they've got to balance the books, but they get loads of subsidy. And they haven't got the capacity to respond to the crisis that we're facing. That's because it's been denuded over many, many years, and it's not just since the 2008 crisis. Although, of course, the things that should have been done then weren't done. And lots of things have been done that shouldn't have been done, and we're now in a very difficult position. Local authorities effectively are going to go bankrupt unless they get more money from central government. But then if more money comes from central government, which is not even clear they're going to give any, it may be a situation where they then basically can control what local government can and can't do.
Okay, well, we did talk about this a couple of weeks ago, didn't we? But the latest articles yesterday on the BBC Bristol homepage, which is racism and neglect are blamed for St Paul's rubbish blight. Institutionalised neglect and racism have left streets in parts of Bristol filled with rubbish and fly-tipping reports ignored, residents say. One homeowner from St Paul's alleged a waste contractor call handler told her the area was never going to be great because it has lots of ethnic minorities. Bristol Waste said it did not recognise the claims on any level.
Well, I mean, the idea that this is what happens in the States. They say, look at all the cities, they're controlled by the Democrats, and this is where all the crime and disorder and poor living conditions are, and that's because they vote Democrat. It isn't. It's because that's where the poor live. And the poor tend to vote Democrat,
but
the problems of poverty are the one.
But this is a Labour city, isn't it? So
all the big
Martin,
cities.
Martin, you would have thought that if it's a Labour administration, it would be the rich Tory voting areas where things like this would happen. But the thing is with the Labour as it is at the moment, it doesn't really seem to be catering for its own voters.
Well, the problem is that the poor create more demand of social services and other services than the wealthy. I mean, the wealthy only ever get from what they get from the council. Somebody collects their bin and that's it. Other people require intervention of social workers and so on. The problems are concentrated in the inner cities. The wealth is concentrated in the suburbs. But the problem isn't an inner city problem. The problem is the greed and selfishness of the political authorities, which basically represent the already privileged and are not prepared to make the resources available to change living conditions for the poor.
People living in the area accused Bristol City Council and Bristol Waste of dismissing concerns simply because of where they live. They said streets were filled with vermin, litter and overflowing bins, and suffered frequent fly tipping. Catherine Jordan, who's 44, claimed when she called Bristol Waste to complain, she was told people who lived in an ethnically diverse area were more laid back about the state of the streets. She said the street is awful, and she talked about that and how damaging it is for everyone that lives there. And she said, I really do wonder about how I've never seen any scenes like this in the wealthier areas of the city. The call handler said, oh, well, it's different in Montpellier and St Paul's. They're just so much more laid back about that kind of stuff. She said something along the lines of, recalling a conversation, that the cultural diversity, the ethnicity means basically it's always going to be somewhere that people dump rubbish because not everyone has the same standards. Well, it's almost implying that ethnic minorities are rubbish.
Well, I mean, that's basically just racist codswallop. The real problem,
this is for Bristol Waste, right? Bristol Waste coming up with this stuff, one of the call handlers, and yet they're saying, oh, well, we don't recognise any kind of racism in our procedures at all. But then there's one of their call handlers apparently coming out with it.
Well, I mean, the call handler is obviously expressing their basically racist codswallop opinions. The fundamental problem is that poor people find it difficult to, you know, going to the dump requires having a car or a truck or something similar. And of course, in the past, the council used to come and pick up stuff. You just phone up and they come and take it. Now, in order to save money, you've got to pay to have it picked up. And of course, poor people think, well, I haven't got any money to pay for this. So they fly to it. And of course, wealthier people, they've got more money. And well, then in Clifton, they don't fly to it.
Well, let me tell you as well that once fly tipping starts, commercial businesses that are up against it for one way or another, maybe because of the lockdown, they also will be using that area to fly tip, because they'll see it as a sort of Trojan horse, and they say, well, if anyone can fly tip around here, we're going to have to do it too.
Well, that's right. And of course, if there's what you might call low level fly tipping going on, same problem in Eastern, then other people will drive in from outside and dump their stuff there, because that's a good place to dump it.
Well, this is the second article in a few weeks about the racism, basically, towards poor areas like St Paul's. It's not a very good record for Britain's first mixed-race mayor, Marvin Rees, the Labour, so-called Labour guy, is it?
Well, I mean, the person who actually dealt with the phone call will have to justify what they said to their line manager.
No, but there's a pattern here, Martin. The fly tipping and the rubbish everywhere in a mainly black area.
Yeah, but I don't think you can blame directly the city council does have a responsibility here, clearly. But the problems are endemic. I mean, the problems of poor areas like St Paul's, where we're sitting now, are not just that the council's racist, although that may be the case. Poor people round here are on universal credit. Nothing to do with the council, and universal credit is rubbish. Causes all kinds of problems. Homelessness, food banks, that's all directly down to Ian Duncan Smith and the rules around universal credit. And the council hasn't got any power over that whatsoever. So it's all very well to say that the council's responsible. The council cannot be the way capitalism works, the way the housing system works, all of it is rigged against the people who live in St Paul's and has been rigged for decades. And the council, of course, can be part of the problem and not part of the solution. But underlying all of this is that local authorities don't have any power. They've got no power over planning. They're basically a talking shop. And that's the problem. And, of course, you've got more power in some parts of the country. Like in Scotland, they've got a national parliament. And in Northern Ireland, they've got an assembly. But even so, they don't have much power. During the furlough and the lockdown, Scottish Parliament has got to balance the books. They haven't got the power to borrow money so that they could carry out their own policy. Ultimately, of course, what the SNP want is independence. And then they can borrow their own money and they can have their own policy. But of course, it's absolutely impossible in inner city areas in mainland England, because the power has been taken to the centre and then basically distributed to the supporters of the regime, who are in the City of London and the wealthy suburbs.
Well, staying with the local area, Bristol's Lost a Legend tributes played to the owner of a late-night blues bar. Celebrations took place earlier this year to remember nights they'd had at the Shabeen, it was called. This is on the Bristol Post. The man who ran the last Shabeen in the southwest, who's described as a cornerstone of the St Paul's community, has died. Gilbert Watson, known as Ajax, died on Sunday, July the 19th, after being diagnosed with cancer. Mr Watson was described as the life and soul of the party, having become well known for his operating the Shady Grove Cafe, opening it in 1970, creating a safe haven for the African Caribbean community in St Paul's to dance, drink and socialise. It quickly became the heart of the area, and so did he. In the 1990s, St Paul's had several after-hours blues clubs, and it became a centre of the free party scene. Earlier this year, many of Mr Watson's loved ones got together in celebration of him and paid tribute to his Shabeen, being the last one in the southwest. Ajax, this is, Martin. Now, this is a glowing tribute to Ajax, and that's fine, but certainly my experience of the place has been not quite so rosy. Anyway, what's your thoughts about Ajax's place? It was on Ashley Road, wasn't it?
Well, I've never been there, but I mean, it's got a fairly mixed reputation, as you say, and I don't know. Some people obviously got something out of going there. Other people, it was always, you know, on the edge of the law, and I don't know enough about it to have a strong opinion, I have to be honest.
Certainly, my experience of chatting to people about it, and my own feeling that it wasn't really the place for me. Obviously, it's one of the places you pay some money to go in, basically. You pay a little bit on the door. Quite a lot of muggings took place in there as well. And there seemed to be a bit of a different attitude towards white girls and white blokes, where white girls were very much welcomed, but white men were more likely to get mugged. So it doesn't seem to me that the Bristol Post is really reflecting the criminal aspect of what was going on there, even though, of course, it was, you know, quite a good place to go if you were one of the regular clientele.
Well, as I say, Tony, I could say all sorts of things, but it's just gossip, isn't it? You know.
Well, certainly, you know, for me, it isn't. It's speaking to people directly who were mugged in there. I mean, this is over the last 15 years, I suppose, I've been living in the city. I quite often spoke, people would say, oh, I'm not going in there again. You know, last time I got threatened and nearly beaten up, I had to hand over contents of my wallet and then I left.
Well, I mean, look, there's all sorts of stories about all sorts of things going on. I mean, I don't really think there's much point us gossiping about it here and now. You know, the guy's died. Some people are unhappy about that, and they want, they remember the good times they've had there. I don't really know enough about it to argue with you, Tony.
This side of our culture, I suppose, the idea here is that, you know, there are clubs and there are criminal things that go on in the big nightclubs too, aren't there? I mean, this isn't just places like this, and I think there is definitely some sort of a criminal underworld working within many of these places, and I suppose it's because they were outside the law in terms of the licensing of the place. That is, I suppose, can create a Trojan horse to allow more criminality to creep in. And that's not just, I'm not just pointing the finger at Ajax by any means, but, you know, other places too, the big clubs, the more, you know, ones with the big budgets and big, I mean, I'm thinking about things like the Lakota. And we've just seen that lady from one of the Lakota owners, going to join the Merchant Venturers. But there's definitely, you know, drug dealing goes on within there, that place, and they have their own, I don't know whether they're official, but they certainly seem to be drug dealers, deals taking place within those joints.
Well, the whole drugs laws are a farce, Tony, as you well know, and that creates criminality makes criminals of all sorts of people who wouldn't be criminals if the laws were different. And Bristol's no different from many other major cities in this respect, in this country or elsewhere. And unless it's one of the things we really need to do is reform the drug laws. And of course, Thangham Debonair, as a local MP here, has actually been quite outspoken about that. And, you know, it's because, you know, places like Bristol would benefit from changes in the drug laws, which would decriminalise a lot of behaviour, which then basically becomes safe or safer than it currently is.
Well, down the other end of Ashley Road, on Grosvenor Road, of course, there was another blues club, not totally unlike Ajax's, called the Crystal Dove, on Grosvenor Road. And that was where the mayor's father, he ran that, Valentine Walker, didn't he? It's a similar sort of an organisation. And that we'll be talking a bit more about that next week. Because this is a topic which is very sensitive in the city, because obviously the mayor's father, being a kind of equivalent to Ajax at the other end of the front line, running the club called the Crystal Dove, is certainly of interest to quite a lot of people. Certainly, I mean, it's of interest because he was involved, allegedly anyway, in getting rid of the anti-apartheid movement in the city. A guy called Balagoon, who we interviewed a couple of years ago, Martin.
Yeah, and you've got to also recognise that Marvin was largely brought up in shelters and so on, because he basically, his mother split with his father many, many years ago, and he has virtually nothing to do with him. So, you know, the idea that you can paint all this onto Marvin is...
I'm certainly not doing that, and
it's rather unfair.
From a criminal family. I mean, I think we just need to be honest about
that. Well, no, his father was definitely involved in criminal activity in the city, but Marvin had very little to do with him. He was brought up by his mother, who is basically a Welsh nursery teacher, and extremely responsible and respected member of the community. And, of course, Marvin himself, as you know, is a regular churchgoer, and has nothing to do with criminal elements.
Well, he's a lay preacher, isn't he, at Christchurch Clifton, which is a, you know, that's certainly part of what he does. And he's also very connected to that Christian scene. His mum, apparently, when he became mayor at the inauguration ceremony, said that she thought that God had wanted Marvin to win.
Well, I mean, I can't make any comment on that, but you'll understand that, you know, his personal life is very much not in that mould that you were talking about earlier. And you know, you've got to recognise that's, you know, like father, like son is not necessarily the case, is it?
Anyway, we've got more info and news this week about Bristol. And before we go to look at COVID, I thought we ought to listen to a chap called Robin Campbell. He was interviewed by somebody called Anna Breeze. She's a former BBC journalist that's been doing quite a lot of internet interviews. The idea really being that if people find that they can't get their news out through the London media of various sorts, or even their own local media, come to Anna and she will interview you and put the interview up on YouTube. So let's have a listen now to Robin Campbell. He's 52 years old, and as we begin our look at the COVID-19 censorship and crisis this week, and the first week of the compulsory wearing of masks in shops, supposedly compulsory anyway, then let's have a listen to Robin Campbell. He's 52 year old and he's an IT consultant from Bristol.
My name's Robin Campbell from Bristol, age 52, and have four children. I'm an IT consultant, and I've been studying this pandemic since it broke, getting more and more suspicious as time got on. But I'll give you some things that I found out during this time. Somebody I know manages the waiting list at the Bath Royal Infirmary, and she said that there's been only 13 cases at the maximum, and the waiting list for everything else has gone skyrocketing. I also know someone who's a consultant, an NHS worker in Bristol, who supports the doctors and the hospitals. And she's been laid off. She's doing one day a week. And she says the hospitals have been empty. She said the surgeries are empty. And she just wants to get involved, but obviously can't. Then I know someone who I walk the dog with, whose husband works at the Nightingale Hospital. That's the emergency one set up at University of the West of England. Again, wasn't kitted out with all the right equipment and has been empty ever since. My concerns have been around the timing of lockdowns and the timing of all the announcements. The Neil Ferguson projections, 550,000 on March the 19th, got downgraded shortly afterwards, didn't they? After the lockdown had been secured, and we should have lifted the lockdown at that point. Then we're supposed to be locking down for further to save the NHS. We clearly got into April and there was no need to keep the lockdown going. We'd saved the NHS. And then I interviewed two doctors. I have a small YouTube channel. I interviewed two UK doctors who came out with all the same information that people are waking up to now. That is, the virus was not isolated using the right science. The tests are 80%, giving 80% false positives and can't be relied on. People were getting referred from hospitals into care homes and causing mayhem and loads of extra unnecessary deaths. People are missing their treatments and surgeries. These two doctors are very experienced surgeons in the world of cancer, and they are so concerned a lot of their patients are not getting seen. They are also concerned about the excess deaths that are likely to come through things that are byproducts of lockdown. So depression, alcohol abuse, drug abuse, domestic violence, and like I've said, missed treatments in their surgeries and missed tests and things. They're also concerned about the influence of big money and big pharma and the vaccine companies influencing all the policy that our governments are listening to. So we not only had the bad numbers from Imperial College, but we had the big money also saying we should track and trace and we should vaccinate everyone. Thankfully in Bristol, we just done a Bristol Live survey, and I think there's about 9,000 or 10,000 people surveyed. 46% have said no to a mandatory vaccine. That's really encouraging. And I've also just watched the Breitbart doctors in America, the Breitbart.com press release with about 8 or 9 doctors all coming out and saying there is a cure, a safe cure. I won't quote it here because I don't want your channel marked down for it, but go to Breitbart.com and go and see these amazing doctors explaining what they found. So I'm kind of encouraged that people are waking up, but I want more people to wake up. My little YouTube channel had 5,000 subs. I interviewed these two doctors. They were struck off immediately. They lost their license. The GMC gave them no time to prepare for their hearing. A 256-page dossier was slammed in their inbox 2 hours before this kangaroo court hearing. And they had their license removed, and then they were denied an appeal. So if anyone wants those interviews, I've got them on video. I'll happily share them with you, Anna. I love your work. I love the fact you're allowing people a voice. And I encourage everyone to keep sharing these little testimonials because they speak volumes. I'm more than happy to send these interviews to people. Just send me an email, robin3108@protonmail.com, and I'll use WeTransfer and send you these 4 hours of interviews. Two surgeons struck off in the UK. So Anna, keep doing what you're doing. Everyone keep sharing. Let's wake everyone up. We're going to do it. We've just got to keep sharing. Thanks for watching.
So, crikey, that's Robin Campbell, Martin. His email address, robin3108@protonmail.com. He's basically saying that there is a very, very sinister censorship going on here, where doctors are saying things which don't fit in with the official government story. I mean, I'm reminded a little bit of 7/7 and 9/11 here. We've got an official story, and if those professionals start speaking out against it, then the system comes down on them like a ton of bricks.
Well, I think there was quite a lot of opinion in the piece we've just heard there. Quite a lot of assertions about matters of fact. I don't really know what exactly the detail of the Breitbart interviews are.
Well, we'll be hearing those in the second hour.
Yeah, well, Breitbart, as you well know.
What I've done from the Breitbart thing is I've just taken a... Because that's, for me, is the big news of the week. It's a very interesting press conference. And on Wednesday, all of the platforms took it down after it had got something like 20 million people had seen it. And it was literally a very important viral video. It's all been censored now. I mean, these concerns that these doctors that Robin Campbell's interviewed here are obviously important, aren't they? They're, we know this is happening. It's not confusing. People have not been treated. They've missed surgery. That they've been discharged into care homes without being tested. That there are questions over whether the tests are viable, or whether there are false positives in them. Patients have simply not been seen. And at the end of the day, these doctors should be surely at least be listened to. Instead, they've been struck off. Now, what happens here is it sends an enormous chilling effect throughout the entire profession, where everybody in the Bristol and Bath area that is thinking about speaking to the media is not going to do so.
Well, I look forward to hearing what you've got in the second hour. But of course, the listenership will know Breitbart is an alt-right website. Very pushy by people like Steve Bannon, tend to be very pro-Trump. Now, that doesn't mean they're wrong, Tony, but don't just presume that because people say this, by saying this over here, RT is saying something over there, Press TV is saying something
Martin,
over there,
Martin,
doesn't
Martin,
mean that they're
you've
right.
You've just missed the point completely, because this is not Breitbart, this is Robin Campbell, who's an IT consultant from Bristol.
Okay, but he's going to use Breitbart later.
One of the tiny things we are going to be talking about, he mentioned there, was this doctor's thing, but that's not what we're talking about here at all. We're talking about these two Bristol and Bath doctors who believe many things that the public are getting, the information the public are getting, is simply not true. In fact, just before I went off to New Zealand in the lockdown, we had an item, didn't we, if you remember, on the show where there was a doctor in the middle of BBC's question time who stood up and said, actually, she didn't stand up. She was sitting down. She was in the front row of the audience, and she said, I'm getting some really good information from the NHS on this and from the government, but the media is the problem. The media is not giving us the right information, and it's actually scaring people unnecessarily. Effectively, I suppose that's what he's saying here, is that we've got enormous censorship going on here in the media.
Well, you'll understand that because it's treated as a public emergency, Tony, there is definitely a public relations strategy by the government in relation to what's going on. It would be the same. It was the same in the Falklands War, but certainly the Cobra has been meeting several times. So you've got a deliberate attempt. They're paying PR people to decide the strategy. Now, there's plenty of critique of what's gone on. My goodness me, I mean, Britain has basically been one of the places where COVID has been dealt with the most incompetence in the world. And there's plenty of criticisms to be made. But, of course, in actual fact, there's loads and loads of different criticisms, and they often pull in different directions.
Well, one of the main criticisms, Martin...
There isn't just one
Martin,
answer.
One of the main criticisms is this idea that we had to clear the decks of the whole of the National Health Service to wait for... these tens of thousands of COVID patients, and that has resulted in lots of people dying unnecessarily who were discharged, not only through them not being treated because they're not in hospital to be treated, and but also the knock-on effect in care homes. So if you're then discharged into a care home, you're potentially spreading the virus there. So that's a particularly awful side of all of this. Let's have a look at the figures, because we had some figures last week out about the number of people who, it was in the Telegraph, it was leaked, a government report saying that the lockdown itself is likely to actually kill something like 200,000 people over the 3 or 4 months of the lockdown. So that's an enormous figure compared to the actual registered deaths of 45,000 for COVID-19 included on the death certificate. And of course, that doesn't mean to say the person has died of COVID-19. It means they probably, certainly the technical term would be they died with COVID-19. So it may be they had all sorts of other conditions as well. So the actual total of people that COVID-19 itself has killed is likely to be a lot less than the 45,000. And yet we're being told in a secret government report that's been leaked by the Telegraph that 200,000 have been killed by the lockdown.
Yeah, well, you'll see that not 200,000 haven't been killed by lockdown in New Zealand. They locked down early.
No, I'm talking about here, Martin.
No, I'm just saying the comparison between this country and other countries. The lockdown here was too late, which is why you've got a higher figure.
Martin, we have this discussion every week.
We do, yeah.
Yes, because the situation here in Britain is completely different.
We locked down too late. That's why it's different.
Well, it's because it was spreading in Britain in December and January and February.
And of course,
Martin, you're just diverting from the question. Here in Britain, we had roughly 3 months of circulation of the virus before March. New Zealand didn't. That's the difference.
Yeah, well, and of course, Hong Kong and Vietnam and Kuala also did very well. We've done rather badly. And there's all sorts of reasons for that. And there's going to have to be an inquiry into all of this. And it will be things like the release of people into care homes. Clearly wrong, stupid, maybe heads should roll. And, of course, lots of questions are going to have to be asked. And, of course, the idea that there's just one media narrative, main media narrative, and then on the other side there's all the truth-tellers who are being censored. I would say to you that, in actual fact, there's loads of disinformation here.
I think you're right, yeah.
There's all sorts of disinformation going on.
On all sides, there's disinformation, yeah. So 45,000 official COVID deaths versus 200,000 lockdown deaths. You haven't really addressed that one.
Well, I think that's right. I mean, but the problem is, if you didn't have a lockdown, maybe you would have had 200,000 lockdown deaths. So in other words, it's a trade-off, but it's a horrible trade-off. And what you really need to do is get on top of it quickly. It started in Wuhan, and the Chinese Communist Party jumped straight on it. They've had less than 4,000 deaths.
Can we just try and go to the origin of this problem here, though? Because much of it seems to be based on this guy, Neil Ferguson, who, he didn't resign, he was kicked out, didn't he, with his model back in March, where he said that something like 500,000 people in Britain were going to die because of the virus.
Yes, and of course that will have to be there will be questions asked about that.
Yeah, and then he revised it down, didn't he, by about 10%.
All right, but that's because let's try and be a bit.
Was he scaremongering?
Well, listen, what's going on here is we don't actually know what's going on.
He was funded by Bill Gates.
Yes, of course he's funded by Bill Gates. But of course, if it was started by Bill Gates, and they're trying to the idea that there's so much going on here that people are not picking up on. The real question is it a bioweapon? And of course, the Chinese Communist Party treated it as if it was a bioweapon from the get-go. Now, if it is a bioweapon, the idea that lots of people could die from it and you've got to take some serious precautions kicks in quite quickly, doesn't it? Chinese Communist Party, they kick straight in. Vietnamese Communist Party, straight in.
But Martin,
the Kerala Communist Party, straight in.
So remember,
in this country, mess around, smack.
Remember,
you're in a difficult
remember
position.
December, January and February of 2019, 2020, I don't think anybody in the world knew what COVID-19 was, did they?
Well, no. Well, what happened in November, as you well know, as the Times of Israel has said.
Maybe the intelligence services.
Yes, the Israeli Defense Forces were told by the American Defense Intelligence Agency that there was going to be a pandemic coming out of China. Now, that suggests foreknowledge. Foreknowledge by military operators. And, of course, people huffing and puffing about, we've got the wrong problem here, it's just a flu and all the rest. It's not necessarily just a flu. That's why everybody's been treating it so seriously.
I don't think it is a flu.
No, it's not a flu.
Nobody would, I think, in their right mind would say it's a flu.
In other words, we still
don't. The mortality rate is something roughly around about the same as a
flu. We don't really know what it is.
And, of course, that's another major problem here.
This question about biowarfare and biolabs, we're going to come to that in a minute.
People were being treated for the wrong thing. That certainly seems to be the case. Anyway, today we've had an announcement from Boris Johnson about halting plans to ease the restrictions in England. So there were going to be all sorts of things, and I think Boris is going to talk about that now. The various things that we're going to open up tomorrow, Saturday, the 1st of August, now they're not.
On Saturday, the 1st of August, you'll remember we had hoped to reopen in England a number of the higher risk settings that had remained closed. And today, I'm afraid we're postponing those changes for at least a fortnight. That means until the 15th of August at the earliest, casinos, bowling alleys, skating rinks and the remaining close contact services must remain closed. Indoor performances will not resume. Pilots of larger crowds in sports venues and conference centres will not take place, and wedding receptions of up to 30 people will not be permitted. But ceremonies, of course, can continue to take place in line with COVID secure guidelines. And I know that the steps that we're taking will be a real blow to many people, to everyone, obviously, whose wedding plans have been disrupted or who cannot now celebrate Eid in the way that they would wish. And I'm really, really sorry about that, but we simply cannot take the risk. We will, of course, study the data carefully and move forward with our intention to open up as soon as we possibly can. 2 weeks ago, I also said that from tomorrow, the government would give employers more discretion over how employees can work safely, whether by continuing to work from home or attending a COVID-secure workplace. And we know that employers have gone to huge lengths to make workplaces safe, so that guidance remains unchanged. We also said that we would pause shielding nationally from the 1st of August, based on clinical advice, and that national pause will proceed as planned, and our medical experts will be explaining more about that decision and about the shielded group later today. Most people in this country are following the rules and doing their best to control the virus. But we must keep our discipline and our focus, and we cannot be complacent. I've asked the Home Secretary to work with the police and others to ensure the rules which are already in place are properly enforced. That means local authorities acting to close down premises and cancel events which are not following COVID-secure guidance, and it means a greater police presence to ensure face coverings are being worn where this is required by law. We will also extend the requirement to wear a face covering to other indoor settings where you're likely to come into contact with people you do not normally meet, such as museums, galleries, cinemas, and places of worship. We now recommend face coverings are worn in these settings, and this will become enforceable in law from the 8th of August. At this stage, we're not changing the rules on social contact nationally. I don't want to tell people to spend less time with their friends. But unless people follow the rules and behave safely, we may need to go further.
Almost ending with a threat there, Martin. So, you know, if you don't do as I say, we may have to go further. Why is it that as the pandemic is conking out, if it ever was really a pandemic all over the world, I suppose, it was in generally around April time, but it certainly doesn't seem to be in the UK anymore, seems to have mostly burnt out. So why are we having even more draconian restrictions being brought in now, which may have been much more appropriate, say, back in March?
Well, it's because they should have been done back in March, and now they're making up for it by doing them far too late, and they're basically facing both ways. I don't think you can presume that you know that that it's all going to go away.
Well, okay, so here we go again. I'll put the graph up of where it's going at the moment. You really have to just take one look at the graph to see that the pandemic is finished. I mean, it's bumping along the bottom. We've had the release of the lockdown, and there has been no second spike.
Well, if you're right,
then or second wave.
Well, then if you're right, well, that's fine. But you can see what the government are doing. It's belt and braces at the minimum. Of course, they've done loads of things wrong.
Is it anything to do with the supply of masks, for example? Because no, they have now. managed to supply lots of masks that weren't available right at the beginning of it, of back in March, at roughly 10 times the original price. And now they're now available.
No, I think what it is to do with is they want the economy to function. But to get the economy to function, you've got to have people going to the shops, but then they're going to spread the virus unless you make them wear masks. What they perhaps should have done is stuck to lockdown. They should have locked down earlier, as other countries did, and then you can actually, in New Zealand, everybody can go to watch the rugby and go to the pub, no problem. It's just foreigners coming in and out that they've got to watch. We're an island. We could have done that. We didn't.
Well, I know, and so is New Zealand. And speaking to people when I was there, they were very concerned that the idea was going to be in New Zealand, that no one was going to be allowed to catch this, not even people who weren't vulnerable to it, and that New Zealand was going to be used as an example to the world to force vaccination. In fact, that's where I heard...
There isn't a vaccine, Tony.
Well, when the vaccine comes, we're talking about...
Will there be one?
Obviously, yes.
Will there be?
Yes.
You sure about
yes,
that?
Yes, I would say definitely. Well, there's about 50 different vaccines.
So.
50
yeah,
different
yeah,
vaccines
none of them,
being
none
tried.
None of them have worked so far.
Well, it's
because colds
it's
are very
bit,
hard to vaccinate against.
It's a little bit early days, yeah? So when the vaccine does come, if the vaccine... Well, go round Martin's direction there. If the vaccine comes, almost certainly when the vaccine comes, in New Zealand, they were very concerned that they were being set up basically for a mandatory vaccination.
Well, the issue with mandatory
and a kind of Übermensch and Untermensch. So people who are have been vaccinated will be allowed to have normal lives. Everyone else will be under the thumb.
Well, when we get to that point, the question of mandatory vaccination is a very big question.
If we get to that point,
I think the main thing is, what got rid of SARS and so on in the past is basically they squashed it at birth, and then if you do that, it's dead. Smallpox no longer exists apart from in laboratories, and in actual fact, that is what should have happened. It didn't happen because the Chinese basically, to begin with, faffed around, and then when they got on it, and by that stage, everybody else, including Britain, had basically lost the plot.
Well, I'm hoping
which
next
is why
week,
we're in the situation
I'm hoping next week to have an interview with Dr. Judith Brown to explain these different types of vaccines that they're working at, because they're certainly not like the successful cowpox vaccine that led to the end of smallpox, Martin. This is a technology which is getting into things like nanotechnology and gene altering. So, in fact, your entire body, possibly the genes in every chromosomes in every cell, could be altered with a vaccine.
Yes. And of course,
this is human genetic engineering.
There's been a lot of question marks about the vaccine industry for years. Those question marks are obviously raising to those who are suspicious of vaccines are very much banging the drum that we don't want compulsory vaccines. But let's come back to what I think is more fundamental. There may be no viable vaccine. In actual fact, we may have to defeat this virus or whatever it is, bioweapon, by using military tactics.
Okay, and I'll post another link to it then to the graph which shows that it has been defeated just by
all right, well, I mean, I'm not going to argue with you, Tony. We shall see.
Okay,
what may happen by the end of the year is we get a massive second spike.
What about this idea of social distancing? Because that's, along with the masks that have been introduced this week, is one of the main planks of the, apparently, to stop the spread, even though it does seem to have spread around quite a lot in the UK over the last 6 months, actually. And Dr. Vernon Coleman, one of your favourite people, Martin, had this to say, and it'd be interesting to get your reaction to it, about social distancing.
The one thing that's doing more harm than anything else at the moment is social distancing. The lunatics who are now running the asylum are insisting that we'll have to retain social distancing forever. In my view, anyone who says this is an ignorant, crypt-orchid poltroon who should be locked up for everyone's safety. The type of social distancing being forced on us is, to use that well-known medical phrase, total bollocks. I'll explain why in a minute. It's social distancing which is destroying lives and which will destroy businesses and everything else which makes our world good. Social distancing forces friends to shout to one another across the street and prevents grannies hugging their grandkids. Social distancing makes people fearful, it breeds distrust, suspicion, and even hatred. Passers-by step to one side and walk on the road, risking certain death if they see someone coming. Social distancing will prevent meetings and demonstrations. It's difficult to think of a business which won't be adversely affected by social distancing. Restaurants are told they'll have to throw out three quarters of their tables and then try to make a profit. Airlines have to throw out a third of their seats and then try to make a profit. Sports arenas can only seat people if they have 6 feet of space all around them. Cinemas and theatres will have to close off most of their seating. Cafes and pubs have no chance. Commercial kitchens will be non-viable. Most kitchens will accommodate only one chef. Who's going to tell the bloke in the big white hat that he has to do the washing up? Hotels are doomed by social distancing. Can you imagine trying to get back to your room after breakfast? I'm afraid there's a one-hour queue for the lift, sir. We're only allowed to put two people at a time in the lift. The theory behind social distancing is that it will protect people from other folk who sneeze or cough. But I think that whoever thought this up is a cretin. And I think that the people who are implementing social distancing are also cretins. Not because they didn't think through the social or economic implications, although that was bad enough, but because a sneeze doesn't stop at 6 feet. And nor does a cough. A cough can spread droplets for 18 feet, and a sneeze can travel 24 feet. So, if we're going to have social distancing, they've got the distance wrong. It has to be at least 24 feet, and really it ought to be 30 feet to be safe. A 6 feet limit is arbitrary and pointless. If we're going to do this properly, social distancing has to be 30 feet. Now, I suppose there are probably waiters who can serve feet from 6 feet away. How many waiters can serve food from 30 feet away? How many people can you get in a bus or a railway carriage if everyone has to be 30 feet from everyone else? If there's a driver on a bus, the passenger will have to run behind. It's stupid. And that's why they didn't introduce social distancing that was of any value. They introduced enough social distancing to bug life, but not enough to do any good. The sensible solution is to push our so-called leaders into forgetting about social distancing completely and to teach people good manners, to encourage everyone to cover their mouths and noses if they sneeze or cough, and to encourage everyone to wash their hands frequently. All quite simple, really. Thanks for watching and listening. Actually, the listening is, as usual, far more important than the watching, and I'm one of the disposable generation. A very big thank you to all of you who have left kind messages. Much appreciated.
So he's really having a dig at this whole thing of social distancing, Martin. I mean, he does use imperial measurements, which is, obviously from that generation. But he's really saying that if social distancing is going to be any real use, it needs to be 10 metres.
Well, if you think back to the actual lockdown, people were supposed to be in their houses. They weren't supposed to be going to the shops. They weren't supposed to be going out anywhere. And that's what was going on. That's what was going on. Yeah? So, in other words, during the actual lockdown, people stayed at home. And, of course, when you actually go out, you've got to have social distancing. Maybe we should have stuck with the lockdown, where we really were keeping people safe in their homes.
So they couldn't go out and buy food?
Well, no, but in that case, you've got to find a way to deal with that.
So you think everyone should have been locked down 100%?
No, well, I'm just saying that the problem with social distancing on transport and all the rest of it only comes when you release the lockdown. Now, in actual fact, if you're going to have a lockdown, in Wuhan, they had a proper lockdown. They locked down the whole city, millions of people. Everybody stayed at home.
Well, surely it's an either-or. You know, surely if you're going out to do some shopping in the time before your social, your lockdown is finished, you should be social distancing, and we had to
well,
then, too.
What they were doing in Wuhan is people who were testing positive were being taken away to be away from their families so they couldn't spread it to their families. There's all sorts of things you can do and should do to deal with epidemics. We've known about it since the Middle Ages, before we even knew about microbiology.
Yeah, and one thing we've never done, ever, in the history of the world, is to lock down people who are healthy.
No, you don't know whether they're healthy or not. That's the problem.
That's the same in all past cases too.
If someone has no symptoms,
why are they treated as if they're a sick person?
Well, it depends, because, of course, there's asymptomatic treatment.
I mean, one of the things that seems to be almost impossible to get through to the government is the idea that there are two different categories of person, one who is vulnerable and one who is not, and that you should treat the two differently.
Well, a 9-year-old girl died in Florida last week.
One.
Yes.
Yes.
If it was your 9-year-old girl, you'd
say... Yeah, but you don't make entire policy on one person in 7 billion people,
do you?
No, you
don't. And you don't make entire policy on people sitting in their armchairs like Dr. Coleman there when the Chinese Communist Party intelligence services think it's a biowarfare attack.
It's nothing
what
to do with
know?
That. Martin,
what does he know about things
nothing,
like that?
It's nothing to do with that. It's about actually stopping spread of a virus. That's all it's about. And he's saying that if you're going to do social distancing, it's going to have to be a lot further.
Well, in actual fact, we should perhaps go back to full-on lockdown.
What, for healthy people?
For everybody, until it's gone. Basically, in New Zealand, it's gone, apart from people bringing it in from outside.
I mean, given that this
that's
is...
what we could have done, and in Iceland.
Given that this is the common cold virus, do you think that makes sense to have a lockdown right across the world indefinitely because of the common cold?
Well, no, it's not a common cold, as you well know.
Well, that is the basis of this virus.
Yes, it's related to the common cold. The question is, I think the whole idea of herd immunity...
In fact, it's less dangerous. Its mortality is less than the flu.
I think that the whole idea of herd immunity has been debunked, Tony.
What, in Sweden?
No, everywhere. In actual
no, it
fact,
hasn't
there,
in Sweden.
No, there is no herd immunity to be had from this virus.
Oh, you think you can catch it? Are you one of those people
well,
that thinks you can catch it again?
Yeah, we don't know, Tony. You don't know, and I don't know.
We'll be hearing...
If it's a biowarfare weapon, which I suspect it is...
I think this is disinformation, Martin.
It's maybe designed to destroy the economy. That's what it's designed to do.
What you're peddling here, I think, Martin, is just disinformation. The idea that you can't build up any immunity to this, I think, is just simply wrong.
It may be wrong, it may be right, Tony.
Well, why are you saying it?
No, because it's still actually an open question.
It's not.
No, it isn't.
It's a closed question. Certainly, the doctors have said that you can maybe get tested for it twice, and that may have been a false positive.
All right. Well, to be honest with you, I think that you've got to actually take a step back and think about what this actually is. But all the people who think it's a conspiracy by Gates and all the rest of it—that's possibly
the question. The really is: what about these measures? Are they necessary?
I don't know.
Are they more than necessary?
No, the British government basically have got no credibility on this. They've made so many errors at every stage of this that basically nobody's taken any notice of what they say anymore.
Well, you know,
that is
the nature of a pandemic which is spreading for 3 months before you realise what's going on.
No, they could have done something about it.
If they thought it was the flu.
The politicians didn't know what the hell was going on, but somebody knew. Defence Intelligence Agency tipped off the Israelis. We could have taken, no doubt we were told as well.
Anyway, some of those figures that we were talking about there, I'll put links up to on our show page at thisweek.org.uk. But also, Martin, to sort of round off our first hour, we've got a fascinating story this week about the Labour Party down in Brighton, which, I mean, I hadn't heard anywhere about this, but I saw it shared elsewhere. Apparently, the Labour Party has suspended so many people as part of the anti-Semitism scandal in the Brighton Labour Party that they've handed the city over to the Greens.
Well, I didn't know that, but it's a shocking mess, isn't it?
So the story is in the Argus. I would have thought that would be an interesting national story. But how Labour lost Brighton and Hove City Council this week. In just 2 days, Councillor Nancy Platt's Labour administration has collapsed. On Monday, the party was rocked by resignations from councillors Kate Knight and Nicole Brennan, both of whom were accused of anti-Semitism. The Greens then became the largest party on Brighton and Hove City Council with 19 seats to Labour's 18. Not even 24 hours later, on Tuesday night, Councillor Platts announced her party would hand over control of the City Council to the Greens, citing failed power-sharing negotiations. Well, of course, the Conservatives and the Greens are not going to make life easy for a party that has basically kicked its own councillors out of the party, leaving the city controlled by another group.
Yeah, well, I mean, the issue here, obviously, is the ongoing struggle over the so-called anti-Semitism in the Labour Party. And... you won't be surprised to learn that I think it's a come on by the Israeli embassy.
But
no doubt I could be suspended from the party for saying that. But there you go.
But what's happening in Brighton is unbelievable, isn't it? That you would actually get rid of people within your own party and therefore lose political power as a result. It just seems to be going a little bit too far.
Well, what you've got at the moment is the right are in the ascendant in the party nationally. And they've basically decided that they're going, I mean, as you know, they settled the court case against the so-called whistleblowers who were Labour Party employees who were sabotaging the last election to prevent Labour from winning. But of course now, I don't know what's happened about this, I haven't been following it, but Jeremy Corbyn commenting that it was a shame that they were paid and they should have taken it to court. And then John Ware from Panorama saying he was going to sue Jeremy Corbyn. Last I saw, Jeremy Corbyn had something like $300,000 to fight that case. So what may happen is that Starmer thinks he's squashed this whole thing and we're going to move on. And in actual fact, it may well go to the Old Bailey. And just think how embarrassing it will be for Starmer and for the government if Jeremy Corbyn wins that libel case.
But the thing is, they seem to want to do these things, and we don't really seem to care about the consequences. A bit like, we want to kick these people out of the party, and we don't actually care if Labour loses control of Brighton.
The way they'd say it is, it's such a serious issue, anti-Semitism, that we've got to be seen to be taking a stand no matter what. And of course, it is a very serious issue, and therefore, people who are accused wrongly of anti-Semitism are quite rightly outraged, because it's a very serious accusation, and those who use it for political purposes to try and, for example, justify the Israeli government's current belligerent stance on things like the West Bank and Jerusalem, and if they claim that anybody who opposes that is an anti-Semite, that is a scandal. Because ultimately, of course, just like in Bosnia and in other places in the world, we're not going to tolerate racism and we're not going to tolerate land grabbing. And if people say, if people don't like that, then that's just too bad.
So where is this all heading? I mean, it just seems to me as if anybody that dares speak out in the Labour Party now in support of the Palestinians is liable to be suspended at any time.
Well, if that starts happening, there's going to be an almighty row about it. And, of course, there is going to be an almighty row about it. It's already happening.
This does disable the party, really, as an effective opposition, doesn't it?
It does. And, of course, we know from the Al Jazeera sting that was carried out on the Labour Party.
Yeah, the lobby.
It was called. That the Israelis say we've got £1 million to spend to make the Labour Party do what we want. And there it all is. It's on the record. The same people that were caught by that sting were also interviewed for John Ware's Panorama programme as disgruntled whistleblowers, when in actual fact they were part of an intelligence scam. And ultimately, that's going to come out in court. And of course, they've got £500 worth of damages now. Maybe if Jeremy Corbyn wins, he's going to get exemplary damages against John Ware. It'll have to be something similar, £500,000, something like that. That should bankrupt him.
Is it going to work its way out, do you think?
Is it going to work its way out?
Yes. I mean, with Keir Starmer in charge, is this actually going to be a solution?
I think what Keir Starmer has tried to do is he's trying to assert himself as being on the right of the party, we're tough on anti-Semitism. But of course, what he could have done is said, well, I'm not going to tolerate anti-Semitism, but we're not going to tolerate this idea that criticising the state of Israel is anti-Semitic. But of course, they've all bought into that by accepting this definition of Holocaust denial or whatever it is, which isn't an internationally recognised definition. It's basically been foisted on the Labour Party. Now, ultimately, of course, this is all going to blow up in their faces when a war with Lebanon breaks out later in the year, and the Labour Party and the Tory government are going to decide whether they're in favour of dropping cluster bombs on civilians in Lebanon or whether criticising that might be construed as anti-Semitic.
Okay, so let's finish up. We're looking at the local possibilities of local lockdowns, which our glorious Mayor Marvin Rees is now in charge of. We may have a Bristol lockdown, Martin. You'd be probably pleased to hear that after the coronavirus case rate increases by 55%. Now, this is the testing kits, which we've heard from the Bristol IT consultant Robin Campbell earlier. There's a considerable amount of doubt over how accurate these tests are, with a 55% increase in the case rate. Now, this is not necessarily anybody that's even ill. It's people who test positive for COVID-19. They may have no symptoms whatsoever. So that is a way, apparently, of locking the city down now.
Well,
if it's a tiny number of people, 55%.
Well, we've seen lockdowns in other parts of the country, in Leicester, looks like Oldham. If Bristol's unfortunate enough to have a lockdown, then that's what will happen, isn't it?
But it seems now that there's a twisting of statistics being used in order to lock parts of the country down, now the pandemic is over.
Well, and you keep saying the pandemic is over, Tony. And
well, as I said, I put the graph up, page at thisweek.org.uk to show the actual levels of deaths are something like 1/100th of what they were at the peak in April.
Okay. I mean, I just basically, when I get on an aeroplane, I trust that I don't know much about aerodynamics, but I trust the people who fly the plane and built the plane to be tested and peer reviewed, and I just get on the plane and it flies and it's like magic. But when it comes to scientific advice about this, I realise that scientists don't all agree and there's different views and all the rest of it. But I think it's basically childish to continuously claim that any government statement about anything is essentially malign and based on the desire to make people have a hard time. It may or may not be. That's open to question.
So you don't think that the coronavirus is being used as an excuse to really quell domestic population, to stop having political meetings, to stop having demonstrations?
The coronavirus has been very helpful for bailing out the Wall Street vultures. And of course, that the Wall Street vultures were collapsing. The market was collapsing in September. In November, the Israelis are tipped off there's a pandemic coming. And then when the pandemic arrives, because they didn't take precautions, because they're not going to take precautions, they need it to get into the US system so that they can then bail the banks out for the second time since 2008. That is the conspiracy. And of course, it may well be that they created the pandemic so that they could bail the banks out. That is the sort of thing that the Russian and Chinese intelligence services are looking into. And of course, you've got loads of people over here who just pretend that it's not happening.
What's not happening?
The coronavirus pandemic as part of a plot to bail the banks out and start World War III, Tony.
Yeah, well, yes, but it's happened. That's what I would say, is that the bailout has happened under the cover of the peak of the pandemic.
Yes, so in other words, the COVID-19... If the COVID-19 pandemic hadn't happened, there'd have been a massive bailout of Wall Street in September last year, and everybody would be screaming, why are we bailing Wall Street out again? Now, because there's a COVID...
And in fact, they wouldn't just be doing that, would they? They'd also be saying, we are not going to do it again. And by the way, you're going to separate the casino banking, investment banking from high street banking, because we don't want everybody's personal savings and businesses all to be sucked in when the casino goes down.
Yeah, well, of course, they had 10 years to sort that out from 2008 and they didn't do it. Now, in other words, it looks very suspicious that this COVID-19 pandemic, whatever it is, because it's certainly good at disrupting things. Maybe it's not the Black Death. It doesn't kill all it comes into contact with, but it does enough to disrupt the economy.
It's even done something to disrupt our loving relationship hasn't it? We're on different sides completely.
No, we don't have to agree, Tony.
No.
We don't have to agree. I've got a different perspective on this than you. I think it probably is a bioweapon. I think it's probably developed by the deep state in the US to smash the Chinese economy
and to allow them
to bail
their
banks.
It's very much like 9/11. It's also dividing families. So individuals within families, maybe even a husband and wife, are in the situation where they have very, very different views about the way the lockdown. So it's been a very effective divide and rule tool.
It has, and of course, as you know from the Gladio years, they're quite happy to stir the pot, create social conflict so that the state and the deep state gains more power. And that's ongoing, whether COVID-19 came along or not.
Okay, so this week we've also seen an introduction of a special coronavirus lockdown for Eid. So Muslims are being told, we are targeting you, we don't want you getting together for Eid, and we're going to make sure that you don't enjoy that festival as you were probably hoping to. And that was all announced late last night.
Well, as we heard Boris Johnson earlier, apologising for it. You know, if you're going to have a lockdown for everybody, then it's got to include everybody, hasn't it?
But this is a special one targeted just at Muslims. That's funny, isn't it?
No, it's not.
Yes, it is.
He said, what Boris Johnson said earlier is, I'm afraid that people are not...
It's not targeted at Eid. It's not targeted at Muslims.
No, what he said was, you're not going to be able to do these various things, and I realise that Muslims are going to be unhappy because it's Eid. He didn't say... He said he was talking there about, what do you call it, gymnasiums. Gymnasiums have nothing to do with it.
No, but this particular thing about restricting gatherings right across the northwest, a lot of people are saying, and I'm saying too, it does seem to be specifically targeted at Eid. I mean, places like Bradford, where, you know, many, many Muslims would otherwise be getting together.
So in other words, what you're suggesting is that the British government has decided to have an intensification of the lockdown in the last 24 hours as a deliberate attempt to frustrate Muslims celebrating Eid.
Yes.
Okay, well, you can say that, Tony. I think it's far-fetched.
Why?
Because they
We've seen Islam targeted right across the world.
Yes,
haven't we?
And but why would, if they were going to do that, why would they? I think they're genuine. They basically said last week we're gonna allow these things to go forward. They're saying this week we're not going to allow these things to go forward.
At the last minute, they changed their mind.
Well, it suggests to me that they don't know what they're doing. That's what it suggests to me. It doesn't suggest some great master plan.
Well, anyway, I would like to see Eid celebrations go on, and particularly religious services, which are guaranteed by the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, the European Convention on Human Rights, the European Court on Human Rights, all that sort of thing, carry on. But no, apparently not. Anyway, we're going to be back to talk about the American frontline doctors, the big, big censorship this week that's been going on by the big tech companies, really showing their hand as working in lockstep, after some music. So that's Karen Ramirez from 1998, 3 years before the 9/11 meltdown that tried to define the 21st century, a song called Looking for Love. And so Into the second hour, censorship is definitely the theme, with Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers and me, Tony Gosling, this evening. American frontline doctors' press conference outside the US Capitol building is censored on Wednesday, simultaneously, by YouTube, Twitter and Facebook, after receiving around 20 million views. And we're going to have a little listen to some of the dangerous words of these American doctors this evening. Moisin Saeed Abbas is a TV journalist who had his Facebook account suspended this week for comments about an Israeli army patrol attacking a disabled Palestinian man in a wheelchair. So what's the real evil in that comment and that action? We speak to him about the mechanisms behind such censorship of journalists. 2 years ago, in the European Parliament, Bulgarian investigative journalist Diliana Gitancheva exposed a secret US military bioweapons program in Georgia and elsewhere, but her questions were disallowed, and then she was banned from the European Parliament building for asking questions of a US representative who was being quizzed there. Could she have uncovered a biowarfare conspiracy that we're now seeing unfold before our eyes? The censorship is coming into the open now, but what about in the past? Have basic ideas like creation or intelligent design been censored over the decades? Has the spiritual also been the target in a decades-long psychological warfare operation? But Martin, we've got to start with this American Frontline Doctors press conference. I was looking up the American Frontline Doctors website earlier today. It's down. That is AmericanFrontlineDoctors.com.
Well, let's see what they've got to say.
It's interesting the way this censorship works is we're trying to discuss something that if you go on the internet now and try and find what they're saying, in fact, what they've said as part of the conference is that all of the stuff that they're talking about is fully referenced on their website, but the website has disappeared.
Well, I mean, that is interesting, is it not? You've got YouTube, Twitter and Facebook are private companies, just like the Daily Telegraph. And if they decide to censor things, they're monopolies.
Are they working for the Pentagon or the British
people? Yes, of
course
they're working very closely with the deep state, but of course they are private enterprises, which means, you know, the Daily Mail is not obliged to give Jeremy Corbyn a fair
crack
at the
whip. So can somebody like Henry Kissinger just press a button? I mean, not saying it's him that's doing it, but somebody somewhere just press a button and say, right, we're taking that down off the whole of the social media spectrum on the internet, and Twitter, Facebook, and Google are all sitting in the same. They basically said, oh, well, if you need to censor anything, just press this button here. They're all actually working in a sort of industry club together to do this.
Well, they are. And, of course, before 9/11, the day before, lots of Muslim websites went down in the US so that they couldn't be able to comment on what happened the day after. We all know that censorship goes on. There's government censorship, there's corporate censorship, and then there's all sorts of people who are basically, you know, for whatever reasons, creating disinformation of various kinds, sometimes deliberately, sometimes not. The idea that there's just one truth out there and, you know, the evil forces of the Borg trying to prevent it, in actual fact, reality is really complicated. There's all sorts of mind games being played. And in actual fact, what you really need to do is unpick all the mind games, which is a great deal of an effort.
Okay, your favourite channel is RT, I know, because you're on there from time to time. But anyway, just a glitch this week. This is in the run-up to the lead-up to look at this American doctor's story. Just a glitch, they say. Google hides conservative and alt-media websites from all search results for hours. This is this earlier this week. Google has excluded major conservative and alt-media outlets from its search results for hours, hiding hits for sites like Breitbart and Red State, even in searches for the outlets' names, only to mysteriously revert to normal later. These conservative sites were in panic Tuesday morning, reporting they seem to have been blacklisted from Google. Articles and pages published by PJ Media, Daily Caller, The Blaze and many other sites were absent, even from searches for the publication name, replaced by links to Wikipedia and other sites talking about the outlet in question, usually negatively, but nothing which would allow you to actually get to the outlet itself. Now this, you know, is something that we've talked about many times, is the censorship of Google, Martin, on this program, and particularly the idea that you can uprank and derank, downrank particular names. So if you're searching for a political figure in the run-up to an election, Google can actually make all of the bad news about that person disappear, and vice versa for a rival candidate.
Yeah, they've got an enormous amount of power because they've developed monopoly power. because in many ways they were encouraged to do that by the deep state in the US. And of course, when conservatives get dealt with like this, they scream and say we're being censored. But in actual fact, as you well know, mainstream media do not give free of freedom of speech to everybody. Of course, things like Ofcom measure, basically deal with FM broadcasting and TV, and certain standards have to be fulfilled, which certainly don't, the print media in this country is blatantly partisan. And, you know, the idea of a free society is not that every media will automatically tell you anything you want to know. You don't go to certain websites, because you don't agree with them, and you go to the ones you do agree with. And that is how the, in theory, the pluralistic society is supposed to work. You've actually got to do the work yourself. You've actually got to go to all the different websites, see what everybody's saying, and make your mind up what you think.
If you're using Google, you're wasting your time, because they're going to make sure you don't find anything that's
worth it. Right, but I mean, we're saying now, don't use Google, you're wasting your time, because they'll basically hide stuff from you. Well, in that case, go and use a different, the free market answer is, well, go and use DuckDuckGo or something else.
You can use Yandex, for example, but then you find, if you're looking very carefully, that Yandex is Google. It's just with a Russian front end on it.
Yes, and in other words, media are biased by the state and by the corporate power.
They seem to have been very well prepared for the idea that they might be on a war footing and completely controlling the information that you're allowed to find and not find on the internet, and make sure that they are also controlling the opposition search engines that you might be inclined to use if you don't trust Google anymore.
Well, indeed, and of course, you know, the obvious thing to point out here is the so-called Chinese firewall. You cannot access various things in China that you can access outside China because they won't let you. But in actual fact, tech-savvy...
And the other way around, of course.
Yeah, tech-savvy teenagers can get their way around that. I mean, ultimately, before we had the internet, I used to have to subscribe to lots of very obscure journals, which were sent to me through the post with all the information which I wanted to find out about what was going on in the world. It was a great deal of effort. And, of course, the internet came along and suddenly it was much easier to find things. But, of course, the problem with the internet is there's too much of it and you don't know which...
Well, not necessarily. At least the whole idea of something like Google is that you can filter those results. But actually, Google is now doing the filtering for you, and I'll explain why. Because I put a search in earlier today after the massive censorship of this interview with the American doctors for this very phrase, American frontline doctors. And there was nothing on there which was actually them speaking. It was all people like this commenting.
Before it was deleted from Facebook, YouTube, and Twitter, millions of people, including President Trump, shared this video. It shows doctors in white coats giving a press conference outside the Supreme Court in D.C. Now, this event was organized by the Tea Party Patriots Foundation, a 501c3 nonprofit. Here's founder Dr. Simone Gold.
We're here because we feel as though the American people have not heard from all the expertise that's out there all across our country.
Gold and the others on screen are actual doctors, and they spend the next 45 minutes talking about COVID and a lot of unproven or false claims about it, like this one from Dr. Stella Emanuel.
So I came here to Washington, D.C. to tell America, nobody needs to get sick. This virus has a cure. It is called hydroxychloroquine.
This is the claim that went mega viral, so let's break it down. Is hydroxychloroquine a cure for COVID? Both the CDC and WHO confirmed that there are, quote, currently no licensed medications to cure COVID-19. Hydroxychloroquine is being researched as a possible treatment, and the FDA originally granted an emergency use authorization for hydroxychloroquine. That lets doctors and pharmacists prescribe it outside its normal use. But the FDA revoked that grant last month because new evidence showed no benefit from the drug, and they, along with the WHO and NIH, urged caution because it was linked to heart rhythm problems, kidney injuries, and liver problems.
So, Martin, no benefit from hydroxychloroquine, say the officials, but the doctors are saying, well, we're on, and that's why they call themselves frontline doctors. They're saying, actually, that we totally disagree with what the officials are saying.
Yes, and they may be right and they may be wrong, but of course they've got a political axe to grind. These are Tea Party supporting doctors.
No, the press conference was organised by the Tea Party.
Stella, whatever her name is, Emanuel.
In fact, what seems to be going on here is quite interesting, isn't it? That various outlets which are right wing or a particular stripe are the only places that certain people can get their information out, and therefore, as you've just done, those individual doctors are smeared with or tarred with the brush of the far right.
Well, they're at a Tea That's Party
the,
event.
The only
they're
place.
Not the far right. The Tea Party
no,
are
actually,
the right.
It's not actually a Tea Party event. It's an It was a press conference organised by a Tea Party supporting senator.
Well, there you are. So there is a political agenda.
Well, that's the only way they can get their information out, apparently.
Well, okay. Then they've had their press conference, and now it's been banned by YouTube and Google and everything. That is a way, that is a game that people play, isn't it? I mean,
do you think that they should have that should have been banned, that video, or not?
Probably not. I don't believe in banning things at all. You might as well let them have their say.
Because this is the point, isn't it?
You're basically drawing attention to them by banning it.
Well, after roughly 20 million views and the whole thing going viral, I mean, this is the whole point, isn't it? That if you're having to ban, I mean, surely if it's wrong information, then why do you have to actually ban it? I don't really see the necessity.
I imagine what's going on here is that the CEOs of Google and so on are talking to the...
How about GlaxoSmithKline?
Yeah, they're talking to the so-called authorities that are officially empowered in the US to give public health information. So they are working with them to have a consistent message. The same thing goes on in this country, a consistent message. This isn't consistent with our message. Please, can you
but
take
this
it
is
down?
The, this is the backdrop.
Now, they should just let people have their
Martin,
say.
Martin, the backdrop to all of this is the cost of various medications and treatments. The vaccine, if and when it comes, will be extremely expensive to produce, and it will make a lot of money for the vaccine firms, for big pharma. Whereas hydroxychloroquine is out of patent, and it costs something like 10 or 5 pence a dose, and the vaccine companies won't be making any money out of that at all.
Well, you may be right. That's a definite, that fits together logically. The question is it true? Hydrochloroquine, whatever it is. I mean, in this country, as in the US, there is actually an official system whereby drugs are either said to be safe or unsafe and all the rest of it. Now, you could say, let's just have a free-for-all and everybody just make their own mind up which drugs they think are safe, or you've got to have some system that decides
which
ones are safe and which ones are not.
But actually, what's happening is surely Big Pharma has basically taken over that system in order to push... I mean, it's basically a marketing thing to push their most expensive treatments.
Of course. I mean, there's an article by Helen Clark, who used to be the Prime Minister of New Zealand, with somebody else about this, and she'd been at a meeting with Imran Khan and also with Ramaphosa, who's the President of South Africa, and they were saying if there is a vaccine, it's got to be produced at cost and provided to everybody. And that means, but what's happening is that the private pharma companies in the West having money chucked at them to come up with a vaccine by governments, but they keep the patent for whatever the vaccine is, and the governments basically say, well, we put the money in, we want our people to have the vaccine first.
First dibs.
Yeah, but in actual fact, what really needs to happen is if there is a vaccine, it needs to be handed out in the South African township straight away, not, first of all, given to Jeffrey Epstein's friends and then gradually working its way down to the townships.
And the funny thing about all this is, actually, in many of the poorer areas, the coronavirus has not been so dangerous, or the mortality rate is not. If I've been looking at some of the figures, and you find that in areas where people are exposed to lots of different illnesses and they're living very close quarters, even like sort of townships and places like that, there seems to be a resistance to these sorts of viruses and viruses for people who are in poverty, because their immune system is bombarded constantly because of the conditions that they live in.
Well, that's what Bolsonaro said. We're not going to get the vaccine. We're not going to have a problem here.
I don't think anyone's saying you're not going to get it at all.
No,
it's just whether you're going to survive it.
Do you know what? Do you know what I actually think? What's going on in the favelas and the townships and the barrios is we don't know what's going on. Basically, middle class world never goes down. Well, so they don't know what's going on.
So anyway, at this sort of time, the best thing to do, of course, is to ask doctors. And it's interesting, certainly, to hear their points of view, even if you don't agree with them. So let's do that now. This is a 45-minute press conference given last weekend up at Capitol Hill by the frontline doctors. They call themselves I've done is I've taken a sort of about 7 minutes, which I thought was some highlights, and I didn't get the senator talking because he's not actually an expert. I thought, let's have a listen to what these doctors have actually got to say.
Today we are joined by Congressman Ralph Norman from South Carolina, and Dr. Simone Gold began America's Frontline Doctors. I am going to turn it to her, and you will be able to hear from the congressman and from other doctors.
We're here because we feel as though the American people have not heard from all the expertise that's out there all across our country. We do have some experts speaking, but there's lots and lots of experts across the country. So some of us decided to get together. We're America's frontline doctors. We're here only to help American patients and the American nation heal. We have a lot of information to share. Americans are riveted and captured by fear at the moment. We are not held down by the virus as much as we're being held down by the spider web of fear. That spider web is all around us, and it's constricting us. And it's draining the lifeblood of the American people, American society, and American economy. This does not make sense. COVID-19 is a virus that exists in essentially two phases. There's the early phase disease and there's the late phase disease. In the early phase, either before you get the virus or early when you've gotten the virus, if you've gotten the virus, there's treatment. That's what we're here to tell you. We're going to talk about that this afternoon. You can find it on America's Frontline Doctors. There's many other sites that are streaming it live on Facebook. But we implore you to hear this because this message has been silenced. There are many thousands of physicians who have been silenced from telling the American people the good news about the situation, that we can manage the virus carefully and intelligently, but we cannot live with this spider web of fear that's constricting our country. So we're going to hear now from various physicians. Some are going to talk to you about what the lockdown has done to young, to older, to businesses, to the economy, and how we can get ourselves out of the cycle of fear. Dr. Hamilton.
Thank you, Simone, and thank you all for being here today. I'm Dr. Bob Hamilton. I'm a pediatrician from Santa Monica, California. I've been in private practice there for 36 years. And today I have good news for you. The good news is that children, as a general rule, are taking this virus very, very well. Few are getting infected. Those who are getting infected are being hospitalized in low numbers. And fortunately, the mortality rate of children is about 0.1%. So kids are tolerating the infection very frequently. They're actually asymptomatic. I also want to say that children are not the drivers of this pandemic. People were worried about initially if children were going to actually be the ones to push the infection along. The very opposite is happening. Kids are tolerating it very well. They're not passing it on to their parents. They're not passing it on to their teachers. Dr. Mark Woolhouse from Scotland, who is a pediatric infectious disease specialist and epidemiologist, said the following. He said there has not been one documented case of COVID being transferred from a student to a teacher in the world. In the world. I think that is important that all of us who are here today realize that our kids are not really the ones who are driving the infection. It is being driven by older individuals. And yes, we can send the kids back to school, I think, without fear. And this is the big issue right now, as Congressman Norman alluded to. This is the really important thing we need to do. We need to normalize the lives of our children. How do we do that? We do that by getting them back in the classroom. And the good news is they're not driving this infection at all.
Hydroxychloroquine works. I'm upset. What I'm upset is that I see people that cannot breathe. I see parents walk in, I see diabetics sit in my office knowing that this is a death sentence and they can't breathe. And I hug them and I tell them, it's going to be okay, you're going to leave. And we treat them and they leave. None has died. So if some fake science, some person sponsored by all these fake pharma companies comes out and say, oh, we've done studies and they found out that it doesn't work, I can tell you categorically it's fake science. I want to know who is sponsoring that study. I want to know who is behind it. Because there is no way I can treat 350 patients and counting, and nobody is dead, and they all did better. And then you're going to tell me that you treated 20 people, 40 people, and it didn't work. I'm a true testimony. So I came here to Washington, D.C. to tell America, nobody needs to get sick. This virus has a cure. It is called hydroxychloroquine, zinc, and Zithromax.
Dr. Dan Erickson, Dr. Gold asked me to talk about the lockdowns, how effective they were, and do they cause anything non-financial? They always talk about the financial, but you have to realize that lockdowns, we haven't taken a $21 trillion economy and locked it down. So when you lock it down, it causes public health issues. Our suicide hotlines are up 600%. Our spousal abuse, different areas of alcoholism are all on the rise. These are public health problems from a financial lockdown. So we have to be clear on that fact that there is, it's not like you just lock it down and have consequences to people's jobs. They also have consequences, health consequences at home.
So the only number that I think is worth paying any attention to, and even that number is not so helpful, but is mortality, because that's a hard and fast number. So the case number is almost irrelevant. And that's because there's a lot of inaccuracies with the testing. And also, even if the test is accurate, most people are asymptomatic or mildly symptomatic. So it's not that important to know. So the case number, which you see rising all the time in the news, is basically irrelevant. And if you had told us a few months ago that that was the number that the media was going to go crazy over, we all would have just laughed at that. I mean, that's essentially herd immunity. There's lots of people out there who have tested positive without symptoms or with very mild symptoms. So the only number that's worth paying attention to is mortality. When you look at the mortality, this is a disease that takes, that unfortunately kills our most frail members of society. People with multiple comorbid conditions, specifically diabetes, obesity is a big one. We don't talk about that, but it is. It's a fact. Coronary artery disease, severe coronary artery disease, people like that. And also, if you're older, it's a risk factor. But the biggest risk factor is if you have comorbid conditions. If you're young and healthy, this is not, you're going to recover. If you're under 60 with no comorbid conditions, it's less deadly than influenza. This seems to come as great news to Americans because this is not what you're being told. There is a lot
of data
on this. Not every clinician needs to publish their data to be taken seriously. The media has not covered it. There is a ton. I've got a compendium on AmericasFrontlineDoctors.com.
Yep.
There is a compendium of all the studies that work with hydroxychloroquine. The mortality rate was published in Detroit less than a month. It was July 4th weekend. They published it. Mortality by half in the critically ill patients.
Mm-hmm.
The patients who get it early, it's been estimated that one half to three quarters of those patients wouldn't be dead. We're talking 70 to 100,000 patients would still be alive if we had followed this policy.
Well, that's a pretty shocking statistic for a doctor to come up with at the end there, Martin. And these are real doctors are saying that let's just say 85,000 people have died because the attempts to stop hydroxychloroquine being prescribed for COVID-19 patients. Now, this does seem as if it's, certainly if you were to believe what they're saying, that this has been a deliberate attempt in order to stop a simple solution to this virus being allowed to be circulated amongst doctors and the population. And it looks to me, fascinating, isn't it, that this AmericanFrontlineDoctors.com website that this week lots and lots of people, journalists included, we want to be looking at because they put all the references to their surveys and things up there, is offline. This reminds me, actually, of speaking to the organic farmer Mark Purdy many years ago, probably 25 years ago, where he was, he got an article about his analysis of BSE and it was basically about the pharmaceutical industry forcing farmers to pour organophosphate pesticides into cows and that causing the trouble, really. And he got an article into the Independent magazine, the Independent newspaper, and literally the same night that that article was in, his phone lines were then snipped. So there could be no follow-up news. Now, that looks to me as if that may be what's happening here with the Americans Frontline Doctors website, so that it's impossible to verify what they're saying because all the information that they put up on the internet has now been censored somehow, or they've been taken offline. Now, the people who were suspected of doing this to Mark Purdy all those years ago were simply gangsters, really, working for the pharmaceutical industry, and it could be exactly the same in this case.
It could. In general, I don't think banning people achieves anything. Basically, as you've said, they've had 20 million hits
It was banned.
It was banned. So the banning, basically ineffective. There's still the question is, are they right? They may be right. They may be wrong.
And I'll put a link up anyway to the full discussion on our show page at thisweek.org.uk. But what about, I mean, do you think in a way they're fear-mongering, saying that the American people are riveted and captured in a spider web of fear?
It's political rhetoric, isn't it? And, of course, there is a political agenda.
But fear is actually a very powerful weapon, isn't it?
It is. And but don't forget...
psychological warfare.
This has been politicised in the US, where, in general, the Democrats have been in favour of keeping lockdowns and the Republicans have been in favour of ending
them. But it's the same here, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So there's a kind of culture war around it.
Yeah. And he's also saying that all this stuff to do with students not being able to go to school, not one documented case of student transmission to teachers, that maybe all those children in various parts of the world, not just in the United States, have lost 4 months or 5 months now of their education unnecessarily.
That may be true or it may not be true. As somebody who works in schools, and I'm a 60-year-old with high blood pressure, I'll probably be going back to work in September. The danger isn't to the kids. The danger is to me.
So I mustn't ask you any awkward questions. I don't want to drive your blood pressure up, Martin.
Well, indeed.
But actually, do you mind? Is it okay?
Well, I suppose we'll have to put up with it.
So I've got another one for you now, which is the mortality versus the case number. This is where we started with the mortality, didn't we? Looking at how many people die. Mm. Now we're looking at number of cases, and that's what's triggering these other lockdowns. But actually, what they're saying is the cases don't matter because you can be positive for COVID-19 with no symptoms and no transmissibility.
Yeah, well, the fact is, we're working out what this thing is.
It's lies, damn lies and statistics, surely. If one statistic doesn't show you, like the death rate, doesn't show you what you want, then you choose a different statistic.
I think the idea that the lockdown has been forced deliberately on... I think what you can see is that they've actually messed up at every stage. They didn't really know what they're doing. It may well turn out that the closure of schools was unnecessary.
Why haven't we heard anything in the mainstream press about these basic things which boost your immune system, like that zinc and what she calls their Citro Max, which is basically loads of vitamin C of various different sorts from different plants. So these two things, plus I would say also vitamin D as well, I mean, to me, that's the obvious first thing to get to anybody who's vulnerable, is to make sure that they have got the building blocks to fight any virus, never mind coronavirus or anything else that comes along.
Well, you've heard of something called a cytokine storm, and in actual fact, that's an overreaction by the body to COVID-19. So in other words, if you actually encourage your immune system by the methods you're saying, that may actually lead you to die because you get a cytokine storm.
I don't think that's medically correct at all.
Well, we don't really know. I'm not a doctor, nor are you, but people have died from cytokine storms,
they certainly have, and that's why actually boosting your immune system can be a good thing, because it means that
your immune system has overreacted. In actual fact, if you had a weaker immune system, you wouldn't get a cytokine storm.
Which is
why people who are smokers, for example, it turned out in France, were less likely to get a cytokine storm because they've got a weaker immune system. The problem with the virus is it actually triggers the immune system, and that can kill you. So in other words, you can't say that I'm not an expert on medical stuff, Tony, but the idea that you can just make it up as you go along, whoever you are, is a load of rubbish, isn't it?
Yeah, well, we're not making it up. What we're doing is we're listening to what these doctors had to say. Yeah. And actually, that very glad you brought up the cytokine storm, because they're saying effectively that's what hydroxychloroquine kills and makes sure that it can't happen. Basically, it's treating your body, the blood vessels, etc., in your body, and the blood itself, which is carrying the oxygen. It's making sure that it can continue to carry the oxygen, and this cytokine storm doesn't stop it doing that, particularly around the area of your lungs. Now, I'm no expert, obviously, I'm not a doctor, but certainly reading around the subject, that's what this hydroxychloroquine tent seems to be doing. And another part of that interview, which we didn't hear there, they were saying, well, actually, this is what we've been doing for years to treat SARS, and it's a normal treatment, but for some reason the regulators, which are, you know, basically being taken over by the pharmaceutical industry, the regulators are saying, oh well, we don't think it's a proper sort of treatment. But then that could simply be because they're trying to actually kill people and make the figures worse for this to exacerbate the measures that the virus that the politicians are able to put in place. Anyway, what do you make of that?
Well, there's a question of whether medication is to be used or not. Now, as you know, as I said earlier, we've got systems in place in this country and the US to decide whether these medications are to be used or not.
Okay,
now,
let's just be clear about what they're saying there. They're saying that you should take the various medications to keep your immune system going well. That is zinc and Citromax and vitamin D, those sorts of things. Then, if you start exhibiting symptoms, then hydroxychloroquine. And this woman, the reason that she's so, I think, so vehemently saying it's a cure is because it's been she has used it successfully on all of her patients. So that's enough to make a doctor think, well, actually, this is working for me. And that's what she's saying there. But so this is what we're really talking about now is why should a doctor who's successfully treated a whole load of COVID patients, at least so she says, be banned from all platforms?
Well, it may be the case, as you suggest, that the big pharma don't want this particular medication to be used because it undermines their desire to create vaccines.
Bottom line.
Yeah. It may be so. I'm not saying it's not. But you can't presume that anybody who's intervening in this debate has not got an axe to grind, because everybody has.
Maybe. Okay, so anyway, let's go on now to look at another aspect of censorship this week. I thought we'd just run through some. I've seen so much attempts to sort of squash stuff, and tech giants all seem to be working. It's the first time I've seen, literally the same time, the same day, all three big tech giants take something down, which is why I'm flagging this up as a major, I think, major news this week. So we're going to have a listen now to, well, this is on a different topic. This is to do with Palestine and Israel. Mohsin Abbas Syed, journalist for Sahar TV. He's based here in the UK. And here he is talking about how his social media post about the Israeli army actually attacking a Palestinian disabled person who was in their wheelchair was censored. He has been booted off of YouTube I think he's been suspended for an indefinite period.
Social media was a godsend to many alternative, narrative journalists or alt media, if you like, because the mainstream media had increasingly quite clearly become government run. Wherever you go, it tended to have a huge stamp of government, edicts and establishment edicts. So social media was meant to be this big liberation for people who really wanted to express independent truth. What's happened over the last 3 or 4 years, though, is that huge behemoth, the corporate social media sort of outfit, Facebook included, Twitter, perhaps others, it's increasingly clear that actually things are completely changing now. I think intelligence services, deep state, governments, they've all got involved with using this term fake news as their pretext for moving in on social media and the freedom that people have had to say what they want. I mean, already the freedom was very dubious, because algorithms and whatnot are also said to control and manage how far people's words were getting out, and of course primarily their businesses, these sites. So a lot of it, the traffic could easily be controlled, it's been alleged and said. And I think my case I guess is similar to many, many cases now. I looked at a video which Facebook had allowed to be posted on their site. And often what they're doing is banning people who are reposting videos that they've already allowed onto their system, which is really bizarre in the first place. But my case was really a video of Palestinian man in a wheelchair being kicked over by the Israeli army. Now, it was a pretty graphic video of this wheelchair fellow being kicked over. So clearly one's emotions get a little bit stoked when you see four or five fully armed soldiers with a track record.
Well, I mean, obviously, this sort of thing is very difficult to do on the radio. So what I'll do is I'll put up a link to the video itself on our show page at thisweek.org.uk. But if you could just describe this video and then, you know, what your response was that somebody at Facebook took exception to.
Well, as soon as I saw the video, there was a man in a wheelchair basically having a discussion with three or four soldiers who were surrounding him with fully f- fully weaponized with their machine guns or whatever. These were Israeli soldiers who were being pretty, obviously quite loud and nasty to him. One of them chose to flip his wheelchair over so that the man in the wheelchair fell to the ground. You know, this is a sort of unarmed, defenseless, disabled man who goes to the ground. And other soldiers then surround him, as well as various other people who were gathered around the incident, and they opened fire. You could visibly see shots being fired at the people around there. So again, it was a sort of example of ongoing Israeli, if you like, oppression of civilians, Palestinian civilians. And in this case, it was absolutely diabolical, a disgusting show of disregard for a disabled man. I mean, what threat could he offer? So I wrote a comment. You have put comments up so people kind of get the idea. I only wrote a one-liner on this occasion, and I alluded to the cowardly, rabid dog nature of the Israeli military for that action.
Okay, then, so you actually used the words cowardly, rabid Israeli dogs.
Israeli military. I said Israeli, not Israel. I said Israeli military dogs. So to me, that's a sort of, it's a metaphor for basically a pack of wild dogs that attack prey, which is easy for them to eat. So to me, it's a sort of, it's a colorful expression. Attack dogs is a common term as well. It's, again, it's the use of language, but the Facebook's ability to basically just switch off without any, recourse to real contesting of the issue. And there's absolutely no clarification of what their community rules are. So they dictate everything, and they dictate the whole kind of scenario. So you can't really do anything. I mean, Palestinian voices, we know, are particularly being stifled within all of this scenario. I mean, I can give you an example of an organization called, I think, the Palestinian Information Center, which had nearly 5 million followers on Facebook, which was just shut down at a whim. So they're doing this to many, many platforms which aren't conforming to their, if you like, agenda. So Zuckerberg, of course, has also, appointed an actual former Israeli, is the director general of the Israel's Justice Ministry on their oversight board. She was actually appointed on their board to oversee what's going on. Her name is Emmy Palmore, I think. Palmore is going to have her own agenda. So if we've got people like this, on the actual board, what hope is there for people like myself or others who've got who are going to express emotionally or otherwise within certain parameters, of course, our expression of disgust at the behavior.
I'm sure Facebook will say, well, actually, it's our platform. You know, we're a private business. We can censor anyone we want.
Yeah, I mean, that's certainly the case. But the fact of the matter is that these guys themselves are not really subject to any particular rules and regulations or laws. I mean, there's a lot of things they seem to be able to do and get away with without any recourse. So maybe it calls into the question who actually does monitor and control these particular social media outfits. If it's going to be the usual suspects, you know, if it's going to be the usual Zio Western imperialist institutions, and that's exactly what it seems to be now. They seem to have their hands in that pie. If, of course, Facebook ever was an independent outfit, because all of these transnational corporate companies, ultimately, if you look at the linkage, they're all part of a happy, cozy little cabal, which all works in tandem. We had the situation before where mainstream media was dominated, for instance, in Britain by six major chaps, including Rupert Murdoch, of course, the Barclays brothers. They dominated British media by and large. And now we've got this situation where a handful of these corporate transnational social media outfits are also controlling what people think and say. I think we're just getting basically a takeover of that social media space by the usual suspects, be it behind the scenes, but it's just you've got a new set of people like the Zuckerbergs of the world who are fronting this particular area.
Mohsin Abbas Said, he works for something called Saha TV, based here in the UK. Martin, what he's saying there in a nutshell is basically the golden age of the internet is over. He's saying, you know, we had this in maybe in the 1960s and 70s and early 80s on television. There was all sorts of great stuff. There was a more balanced journalism. That all got shut down. It started happening in the noughties on the internet. Now that's all being shut down. He's saying that's it. No more golden age of the internet.
Well, I mean, when the internet first came in, the idea was that you will, if you put in a search term, that it will, without any kind of bias, just lead you to what most people are already looking at. And of course, people still presume that that's what's going on when they put in a search term into Google. But it's quite clear it isn't. And of course, this allows those behind these platforms to manipulate public opinion. But of course, they are manipulating public opinion. It's more subtle, but it's not really different in kind from the manipulation of public opinion carried out by, you know, mainstream media for many years.
It's like people have been sort of herded around. So we got, you know, literally billions of people herded from one place to another. So you've got mainstream media starts being censorious, lying, etc. And people think, oh, well, I don't really want to watch that anymore. I don't trust it anymore. I'm going to go onto social media. And so as millions and billions of people go onto social media, so it's time for that to be shut down too, I suppose. It's possible that there'll be other forms of social media that pop up as alternatives, you know, a bit like that site which Edward slips my mind now, but Edward Snowden started working for them in VK.com
yeah.
or VK.ru,
yeah.
and there are others sort of popping up as alternatives to Twitter. So I think one of the things I'll do on my show page tonight at thisweek.org.uk is put up a link to a couple of those, an alternative Facebook and an alternative Twitter. But you know, this does suggest that this is being done for a purpose, doesn't it? Is it just being done for money, for big pharma, for the arms firms? What ultimately is the aim of all of this?
Well, I mean, those are the big questions. I mean, basically, the deep state in the West is beholden to the banksters, and it's beholden to the military-industrial complex. And if, you know, when you start thinking, well, what's the motive behind all of this? You start to realize what's going on. They're basically trying to control the 21st century in the way that they control previous centuries, but they're finding it difficult to do.
If you think about those tech giant companies, you know, Twitter, Facebook, Google, in fact, including all sorts of other ones like Amazon, LinkedIn, these are all Bilderberg firms. In fact, the bosses are going along to the Bilderberg meetings over the years, and we're supposed to believe, apparently, that there's no Bilderberg meeting this year. Well, I'm quite sure there have been, certainly, of the steering committee. And the interesting thing about that for me is that over the years, that sort of organisation, which is basically a private lobby in the NATO countries of the most powerful and wealthiest people, in a group which was started by a former Nazi SS officer back in the 1950s, is that it started off as banking and oil. Now, it seems that information is the main key there, is that actually controlling the news is what these modern day Nazis really want to do.
Yeah, well, there's been a development arc of all of this, hasn't there? And what they're trying to do now is, at one stage the internet was a kind of alternative forum, but now, of course, groups like Brigade 77 and the Integrity Initiative and, you know, all of these kind of basically quasi-state intelligence service groups are basically involved in manipulations on social media and also...
Well, they're cutouts, aren't they, really? Yeah. You know, so the idea is that you've got a private organisation, MI5, MI6, whoever else can say, or in fact, even a particular individual arms company that's paying for them. Yeah. So it's nothing to do with us, folks.
Well, that's actually... So you've got Bellingcat, Elliot Higgins, who's basically, you know, he was basically supposedly unemployed, and then he became an expert on Syria just by looking at online. And of course, he's presented in the mainstream media as independent journalist Elliot Higgins of Bellingcat. But in actual fact, Bellingcat is funded by the National Endowment for Democracy, British government, etc., etc.
NATO.
So they're,
NATO.
So they're pretend. There's a pretense. It's like AstroTurfing.
Is it the Atlantic Council?
Yes, it's AstroTurfing. You know, so they've got all these things out there which look as if they're independent sources, and in actual fact they're part of the government.
I mean, it's interesting. One of the best places to go to look at whether a source is really independent or not is a place called Spinwatch. That's run by Professor David Miller here at Bristol University, and he's recently been booted out of the Labour Party, hasn't he?
He has, yeah.
As an anti-Semite. So anyway, going back to Mohsin Abbas Saeed's censorship, I thought it'd be interesting to ask him, because this is all focused around the Israel-Palestine conflict, as so much seems to be, about the Israel lobby and how it actually operates online. So let's have a listen to that now.
The Israel lobby's job is to make sure that Israel exceptionalism in the world is maintained. They have that exceptionalism. They had it for decades already. They just want to go to the next level. Nothing should be questioned. There's this kind of desire for everybody to keep their mouths shut as Israel becomes more and more totalitarian, which it has to, because Israel is illegitimate, is surrounded now by a new wave of, if you like, especially Arab descent, called the resistance axis. It includes people that they've already proscribed now as terrorists, because again, the same institutions, Israeli exceptionalist institutions, have kowtowed to their desires to name whoever they want as terrorists. So what they've done is they've really cleared the ground for any opposition to what they want done in the Middle East, in that region, from the Western sources. So stopping Britain, the Netherlands, America, all of these powerhouses with their wealth, with their influence, with their democracy, with their talk about liberal democracy and human rights, well, that's all been silenced now. You can't squeak, because the minute you say anything against the Israelis, or you say anything against Zionism or Zionists, the Israeli lobby will trigger whatever they have in terms of blackmail, whether it's through the blackmail of being termed an anti-Semite, or other blackmail, because, you know, so you don't forget that these guys, Israelis, have got the Unit 8200. They've had the Talpiot program, which essentially has high-tech chaps who are distributed across the entire Western world now as well. And they are, in extension to the Facebook argument, you've got these guys from the Talpiot program. Look up the Talpiot program that Israel has, which develops some of the highest powered techies who are then distributed into important positions around the Western world. Now, it's this kind of, if you like, influence, this kind of direction of political policy in the West, which is what they want. And they want, they've got their people all in place. They've got the money men in place, the money lenders and the money mafias, money power. They've got that on their side. And they intend to use that to manipulate things.
I mean, tell us a bit more about this Talpiot program, because that sounds to me as if you're saying that they're deliberate infiltrators. But then it might just simply be that the Israelis have got such good education systems around IT that their people are snapped up around the world.
Well, you know, $35 billion of aid from America pours into Israel, not without reason. There's the entire diaspora of money mafia, which also pours in privately funding to these institutions. Keeping Israel on its feet requires a lot of money, and it gets that money. And the Talpiot program, of course, if you've got industrial espionage, if you've got individuals dotted out around everywhere, if you have influence in the Congress, and if you have influence in the British Parliament through the lobbies, whether it's IPAC or whether it's the Israeli, the friends of Israel here in the Conservative Party, etc., etc., if you've got such power and a fantastic organization, without a doubt, they've got an immensely powerfully organized network of intelligence, of influence politically, of influence financially, and of course they'll use it to survive and to not only survive but to actually dictate where things are at and where things will go. And I think the Talpiot program is just one visible example of which they happen to have released to show off, to say, look, this is the scale of power we have. But let's get down to the brass tacks. this internet we're talking about, ultimately, the flow of traffic through this internet, I've read reports where it's alleged that this traffic actually all passes through the Israeli networks. And ultimately, if Mossad and if these networks have access to codes, well, how far does it go? Does it mean that the Israelis have actually secretly, do they have access to nuclear codes, of whether it's the British nuclear weapon systems or whether it's the American weapon system? Is that why Israeli exceptionalism is so easily acquiesced?
Well, I don't think the Royal Navy or the British Army or whatever would put their nuclear codes anywhere near the internet. I hope they wouldn't anyway.
Well, one would hope not, but I'm just wondering that if the level of infiltration, I mean, all of these codes ultimately, are they going to be punched in manually? Do they get punched in? Who keeps these codes? Where do they store them? I mean, my question is the deep state and the shenanigans that go on there, and Israel's actual power within that field is very, very worrying, and I think to underestimate what they're capable of and what they actually do is really highly naive, given the scale of infiltration. Look, we constantly talk about Russia influencing our elections, yet nobody squeaks about Israel and its influence over parliamentary groups. Nobody talks about the funding and finance that goes to parliamentarians. Why not? Why isn't that an issue? Whereas Vladimir Putin is constantly, even today, being accused of having a hand in either American election gerrymandering or the British elections. But nobody talks about what's openly in our face, which is that Israel and Israeli lobbies and those forces that are fanned out across our systems, and if they're embedded to the structural systemic order, how far does that go? I mean, and would any investigating journalist even get as far as being able to suss out how far that goes these days? I doubt it. I mean, these days you're getting slammed for saying that the Israeli army are barbaric, dog-like creatures for attacking wheelchair-bound people. I mean, far less would anybody be able to go out and investigate the depth of what Israeli power and control is.
Yes, I mean, I think in a way that's the most powerful point he makes right towards the end there, Martin, where he's talking about the criticism of Russia, but no criticism of Israel for influencing elections. Now, we know that there are extremely powerful lobbies here in the UK and in the United States, directly funded through this $40 billion or so that goes to Israel every year.
Yeah, well, and this all came out in the lobby, the Al Jazeera program. Where the Mossad agent, whose name now escapes me, says, well, we've got £1 million to spend to get the Labour Party to do what we want it to do. And, of course, that £1 million isn't from Israeli taxpayers. That's ultimately US taxpayers' money. It's extraordinary that Israel is in receipt of massive amounts of taxpayers' money, when it's basically a developed country.
The guy's Shai Massot.
So why do they get all this help?
Shai Massot, who was, one of the attaches at the Israeli embassy, he was going around, basically offering money and bribes in order to remove politicians, of various sorts.
Well, he said he was going to get rid of Alan Duncan, didn't he?
Including in serving politicians in the government. So that does seem to be better evidence than the evidence of Russian interference. Well, why is the media, do you think, Martin, why is it so biased against Russia and pro-Israel?
Well, I mean, basically what we're talking about here is warfare and propaganda, isn't it? So the Russians are the enemy for the deep state in the West. The Israelis are allies, just as the Saudis are, and therefore they're given, whitewashed and encouraged, and supposed to think of them as people like us. Whereas, of course, the Russians, their eyes are too close together, and they don't think like
us.
This
is all very much like racism, isn't it? Is there a sweet spot beyond which, if you push the propaganda, it stops working?
I think that's true. I mean, the only thing you can say about the crazy level of propaganda to which the population is now subjected is that eventually it becomes, it looks like the majority of the population really think there is something behind the idea that Russians are fixing elections in Britain, which is pretty ridiculous when you think about it, because the evidence just isn't there.
So if you tell a lie enough times, that people start believing it.
Yes,
and
I mean,
the bigger lie, the better.
Well, I mean, if you think about this, the idea that the Russians are influencing elections really comes back to the leak of the DNC emails which showed that the Democratic National Committee in the US was rigging the primaries in the run-up to the 2016 election to make sure that Bernie Sanders didn't win. Now, even if the Russians had basically got that material and put it out there, the fact would remain that what was going on is the election's being rigged. But of course, they instead of going on the election, the CIA basically said, well, this makes America look really, really bad. It looks like we're rigging elections, and that must be the Russians' fault. No, it's not the Russians' fault. It's your fault. You're the ones who are rigging the elections, not the Russians.
So are the Israelis rigging the elections?
The Israelis are much more active in trying to rig elections in the West, specifically in the US, but also in the UK.
So how do they do that?
How do they do that? Because they've got a lot of money to spend on social media and all the rest of it. They've got time to go and find our friend that was talking earlier and take his video down, because they're being paid for by US tax dollars being given to Cyanim in Israel to do these jobs. And of course,
what do you mean by that, Cyanim?
Well, Cyanim are people who work for Israeli intelligence, but they're not directly employed by them. So
the sympathisers.
The sympathisers and
agents of influence.
Agents of influence and so on. Now, basically, as you can imagine, people all around the world, whoever they are, governments, organisations, individuals, are trying to influence events by using media and other mechanisms. But of course, it's a very unequal struggle.
Well, you can influence events, can't you, if you can get a politician to sign on the dotted line because you've got evidence of their crime or their paedophilia gathered through people like Ghislaine Maxwell and Jeffrey Epstein.
Yeah, well, I mean, the point about Israeli intelligence services is they are incredibly active. They're not just a kind of passive little group that sort of, you know, tries to prevent threats to the state. They are proactive. They've got a long-term view. They clearly want a war with Iran. Let's just remind everybody, Netanyahu wants to go to war with Iran. Anybody listening to this has got to decide whether they want to go to war with Iran, because that's what's going to happen, and then you're going to be at war with Iran. Do you want that? Did you wish for that? Because if you didn't, you better speak up now.
Okay, well, generally, apparently people believe that Donald Trump is fighting against a secretive, evil global cabal, members of which include former Democratic presidential candidate Hillary Clinton. Now, this is a conspiracy theory called QAnon. I'm not quite sure what that term means. I mean, it's a bit of speculation about criminality, maybe, or it might be a deliberate ruse in order to confuse you. Somewhere between the two, most of these things are, but it certainly doesn't. It's not a helpful term, conspiracy theory. But anyway, the billionaire liberal philanthropist George Soros apparently could also be involved, and they have both been hate figures for the American political right for many years. And I'm talking here about something called QAnon, which is a conspiracy which the BBC have been looking at this week, Martin.
Yeah, well, I mean, basically, that those people are saying that the deep state in the US, which is aligned with the Clinton Democrats, is trying to get rid of Trump. Well, I don't think there's much dispute about that. They are. That doesn't mean that Trump's right and they're wrong, or vice versa. The real scandal, as I mentioned earlier, is that Bernie Sanders was prevented from running in 2016, and he really is an outsider. But and they've all ganged up to make sure he doesn't get a chance to have a go.
But I mean, I missed out a certain important part of this QAnon, which is the supporters of it believe that a person or group inside the administration, the eponymous Q, is posting coded messages online to inform Mr. Trump's supporters about this secret war, preparing them for an imminent event in which the president overthrows the evil cabal and imprisons its members.
Yeah, and basically they're saying, trust us, this guy, we don't know who he is, Q, is giving us all this inside information, and it's absolutely 100% true, and you should believe everything now, he says.
So isn't this a sort of one of those techniques, though, where what you could do is you can take a whole load of absolutely verifiable facts, true facts, and then add one or two pieces of poison into the middle of that, mix them all up, and then you're saying, well, actually all those facts are just a crazy conspiracy theory, and what you're doing is you're pointing to the planted fake fact in order to discredit everything else.
Yeah, I mean, basically, you're going to find people online are going to follow the things they believe in. And the people who are following QAnon are generally hardcore Trump supporters, and the sort of thing they read when they go there, it confirms what they believe. In actual fact, I don't think there's much dispute that Trump has been at war with certain elements of the deep state. They don't like him. He's not one of theirs. And they'd rather have somebody else. That doesn't mean that he's, you know, there's other factions of the deep state are very keen on him and quite like him. And, in other words, we've actually got a massive power struggle going on between two different factions of the US ruling class. And, the rest of us are watching, powerless to intervene as they fight with each other.
I mean, how do we interpret this QAnon? I mean, how can we make sense of it, Martin? Because it seems as if the whole thing is shrouded in poisonous disinformation.
Well, I mean, I, to be honest with you, I've read about QAnon, but I haven't actually looked at all their stuff. But I mean, the whole point, as you say, is that they claim that they're getting inside information from, you know, this mysterious Q who's telling them what's really going on. Now, you've either got to believe that or not believe it. They could basically be making it all up, couldn't they? Let's face it, they could. And it doesn't mean that maybe they're not. Maybe they do have a genuine informant. Maybe they don't. But you've also got, you know, everything you eat, you've got to put a pinch of salt on it.
The main person who is seen as the level-headed spokesperson on QAnon is someone called Professor Stephen Lewandowski. In fact, we carried an interview with him. He was at the time, Professor of Cognitive Sciences at Bristol University. And he was discussing fake news when this was all sort of emerging a few years ago. Mm-hmm. I could put a link, I think, up to on our show page at thisweek.org.uk to that show, reading between the fake news lines with Bristol University Cognitive Science Professor Stefan Lewandowski. And what he's effectively saying there is that these things are actually fascistic. But what we pointed out in that program, Martin, is that this is actually also a technique to destroy truth. So what you do is you bundle truth together and then you put a bit of poison in the middle, a little bit like poisoning the well.
Yeah, well, I mean, this is the problem we've had as we try to understand what's been going on since 9/11. There's lots of legitimate questions to be asked about that. But, of course, the way you ridicule people asking those legitimate questions about what was clearly an inside job to anybody who's got any sense of, who's looked into it in any serious way, you just link it to all sorts of extraneous stuff, you know, UFOs, anti-Semitism. You know, all the time people are, there's a lot of work goes into creating misleading narratives.
Well, they're talking about an evil global cabal, QAnon. I mean, is that feasible?
Well, there is an evil global cabal, but they may be part of it. You know, the idea that Trump is some kind of a saviour from the evil rogue cabal that's running the US. Trump is the one who killed Soleimani, or at least Pompeo gave the order, but Trump just signed it. So he nearly started World War III there. Now, no doubt the QAnon people think that was a good idea. And they say that he's fighting the deep state. Trump is the deep state. They are the deep state. America lives in an absolutely narcissistic universe where they don't really... even those doctors we heard earlier, they're going about America, America, America. If you like saying the whole world is involved in this, it's not just you. But they live in a land of their own.
In this case, Professor Stefan Lewandowski, yes, he's still at the University of Bristol, explained to Vox magazine, encouraging supporters to internalise any evidence which contradicts the claim of Q, simply as evidence of the conspiracy against it. So, in a way, what he's saying is that, you have to take this all as one. You can't sort through and say, well, actually, this may be true, this false, this true, this false. You have to take the bundle as a whole. And actually, we know what journalists do is definitely not to do that. You don't take everything and say, well, that's a load of rubbish or that's wonderful, because you could easily be throwing the baby out with the bathwater, and people are basically too lazy. Well, no, actually, that's not a fair term to use, is it? Because journalists should be doing this job. They should be going through that information and saying, well, this stands up, this doesn't, this stands up, this doesn't, rather than saying the whole thing is rubbish and throw it all out.
Well, don't forget the QAnon people are saying all of this is 100% true. Yeah? Don't question what we're saying. Question what they're saying. They're lying, but we're not. But that's what they all say, isn't it?
Okay, continuing on the theme of censorship, let's go and have a listen now to our correspondent from Abkhazia on the east coast of the Black Sea now. That's Manfred Petrisch. He is a former Swiss, he worked most of his years in the Swiss financial system, and I found out from him this week something I didn't know before, was that he was booted out of his job, booted out of Switzerland through bullying over his finances. So he started expressing views which were extremely challenging, Martin, to the official views on things like 9/11, and he found things like bank accounts frozen. Does that surprise you?
Not really. I mean, that's the world we live in, isn't it?
So let's have a listen to him now.
I haven't had the flu and the influenza in the last 15 years. I've never had influenza. And the reason is because I always take care of my immune system. Because that's the best way to fight off all infections. If you have a good immune system, if you take care of that with vitamin D or other things that help your immune system, you will not get sick. You will not get the yearly flu, and you will also not get COVID-19. That's where the people, that's where the government should put their emphasis on improving the health of the people and not on the vaccine. You see, you have to solve the problem and not do the side things. You understand?
Yeah, go to the root of the problem.
Exactly. The root of the problem is a lack of that the body cannot fight off this virus by itself. That's where the problem is. A weak immune system. And that's where the government should come in and say, tell the people how to strengthen it and improve it.
Yeah, well, that's interesting, because the governments haven't been saying that, and neither has the media. This is amazing, really, that surely, even if the government has forgotten this question, surely the press should have picked up on it and said, you need to be taking vitamin C, zinc, vitamin D, that sort of thing.
Yeah, but don't forget, look, the media in the West, in America and also in Europe, is going absolutely down the drain. That means I have the latest figure from Germany. All the big newspapers and media and private televisions are losing between 10 and 20% of readership and viewership. 10 to 20%. So they are really in a very big economic problem. And what is happening is that the government has to now bail out also the media, and they are getting money from the governments, and therefore they have to, there is a saying in German, who pays decides what music is played, if you understand what I mean.
Well, that's, yeah, in English, that's who pays the piper calls a tune.
Exactly. And that's what's happening with the media. They are now completely dependent on government bailouts and handouts because the people don't believe them anymore. They ignore the media, but the media has to therefore bring out the propaganda of the government. That's why they do what they are told. That's why they don't criticize. That's why they don't give alternative views. That's why the alternative media is being censored and locked and kicked out of Skype and out of YouTube and out of Facebook and everything, right? There's an information war going on.
If there's a view that that certain powerful people don't agree with, governments, press, whatever, that YouTube, Facebook are taking those views down.
Well, why do you think I had to go out of Switzerland? The main reason why I had to leave Switzerland is because my views that I was expressing and my way of explaining the reality was not accepted, and I was threatened. They tried to kill me financially. They tried to block me in every way. And I had to leave Switzerland, and a lot of people don't believe this because they think, oh, Switzerland is a democracy. That's not true. Switzerland is just is not a democracy. It's just the facade of a democracy. It is it's not real. And if let's put it this way, as long as you say what the government wants, then they don't touch you. But if you start criticizing and showing the real things, then you will really notice how a hammer will hit you, right?
Well, so how were you got at? I mean, what things happened to you?
Well, they closed my bank accounts, and I couldn't access anymore all my bank cards. The same happened, by the way, to Julian Assange. Look, when Julian Assange came to Switzerland, he applied for,
asylum?
Asylum. And he had bank accounts in Switzerland where the people could pay in, to WikiLeaks.
Donations.
Donate to big WikiLeaks. As soon as this was announced that he wanted to have asylum in Switzerland, PayPal, all the Swiss banks, even the Post Bank closed down his accounts and all his credit cards were cancelled. Well, that's how you kill somebody. If you kill him by not giving him access to finance, well, then he's dead, isn't he? And you can't move anymore. You can't do anything anymore. And that's what happened to him. And that's what also happened to me. And it happens to everybody. What's the demonetization at YouTube? What is that? That's exactly the same thing. Don't forget that the whole purpose, allegedly, of NATO is to be a defense alliance and against the Soviet Union and the Warsaw Pact. I mean, although the Warsaw Pact was formed after NATO, but that was that we were told this from the 1950s on, that NATO is to protect Europe from the bad Soviet military aggression, right? That's what we were told. Now, when in 1989, 1991, the Warsaw Pact collapsed, dissolved, and the Soviet Union collapsed, and the enemy of NATO disappeared, there was no need for NATO anymore. I mean, if you don't have an enemy anymore and it's just gone, why do you need still this huge military organization that costs a lot of money, taxpayer money? So what happened is instead of dissolving it and also getting rid of it, it expanded. And it expanded into the vacuum that the Soviets left regarding East Europe. So the whole, all those Eastern Europe countries were sucked up into NATO, and Russia was surrounded from Turkey right up to Norway. Then look, the whole Balkan War, this illegal, completely illegal war of NATO against Yugoslavia. And not me, I'm not saying this, it was Chancellor Schröder who said this on TV in an interview. He said, I made a criminal act by ordering German planes to bomb Yugoslavia during the NATO attack. That's exactly his words on TV in an interview. So he confirmed that the NATO attack against Yugoslavia was completely illegal. It was an act of aggression. And the whole point was to split up Yugoslavia into all these small countries, in all these small states, and then give the Balkan Mafia their own country, what's the name of the country? Which was part of Serbia, and they could create a military base on the Balkan. Camp Bondsteel is the biggest military base in Europe, and it's in the Balkans now. That was the whole point, to get the Russians out and get NATO in. Well, the wider picture is that we are all these moves that are happening from this West. I mean, I wanted to answer your question before regarding NATO. You see, NATO has been looking for new jobs to do, and the latest story is that NATO is expanding into the Pacific. Can you imagine that? North Atlantic Treaty Organization is saying we have to also go into the Pacific, and Australia, New Zealand, and all those Pacific countries have to, and Japan and North, South Korea, all have to become members of NATO. That's the latest statement from the head of NATO. What I was explaining in my article you mentioned. The expansion of NATO into the Pacific. Well, and they say NATO is saying China is our enemy and we have to confront them at their door. So that's what's happening. So the big picture is that they are not only moving ever closer to the Russian border and they're sitting in front of the Russian border and they're doing these huge maneuvers in the Baltic Sea and in the Black Sea and provoking the Russians all the time. They're doing it also by moving 3 aircraft carriers in front of the Chinese coast. And all these things. Can you imagine what would happen if the Chinese or the Russians would come with their aircraft carriers in front of San Francisco and New York? What would happen then?
Yeah, or sail them up the Thames, maybe.
Well, and go into the Gulf of Mexico and cruise around in front of the nose of the Americans? That would be an act of war. In the view of the Americans. But it's okay for them to cruise in front of the nose of the Chinese and Russians all the time, right? That's okay. The Russians and Chinese have to accept that.
But you must admit, I mean, the Russians are being very provocative by shooting down or doing a test of shooting down a satellite. That is quite provocative.
Well, that's not provocative. That is only the answer to President Trump's move a year ago to create the Space Force. You know, what Reagan dreamed up, Star Wars, and he is now putting all the money into it and creating this new arm of the forces, of the military forces going into space. He wants to militarize space. And what the Russians have done is only a signal to the Americans, well, if you do that, we already have a weapon to take care of that problem. This is not a provocation, it's a signal.
It's not a provocation, it's a signal. So they're saying, effectively, Martin, aren't they, that the Russians, there's lots to talk about there, but particularly on last week's satellite destruction by the Russians, as a test apparently in space to see if they could destroy another satellite, is that they're not actually doing anything specific, but they're saying to the United States and the rest of the world that if you want a war in space, we're up for it.
Yeah, I think the Russian position officially is that nothing happened. So they're also, you know, you can see there's all sorts of ways in which these kind of diplomatic signals are sent. At the same time, they probably are sending a message, look, we've got one of these, watch out.
Okay, I mean, certainly the way it's reported has been skewed. Some websites, like the Asia Times, for example, saying it appears that a deadly satellite killer has been released. You know, now other websites say, for example, newspapers here have been saying it is, you know, as stating it as a fact.
Yeah, and I'm, don't quote me on this, but I understand that the official Russian position is there's nothing to see here, folks. It's quite likely that they are developing such weaponry. It would be surprising if they weren't. And of course, this is the problem for NATO and the Western Alliance, is they're totally dependent on this high high-tech electronics and satellites.
I feel we're,
and of course they can be shot down.
I feel we're almost sitting right in the middle of no man's land here, with shells flying across us, maybe information shells, because it seems to me that much of what the West's strategy is depending on total propaganda and complete control of our media, without any kind of questioning, without journalists even asking basic questions that somebody down the pub would raise.
Well, then the question somebody down the pub might raise is, why are we sending an aircraft carrier from Britain to the South China Sea, where it's going to be a sitting target, if there is a war, for Chinese missiles?
Talking of
makes
which,
no sense at all, does
talking
it?
Talking of which, have you been to the pub yet?
No. Nope.
I'm hoping, Martin, that one week we will have persuaded you to go to the pub and you'll be able to come back and report what the situation is there. I mean, and if you've managed to have...
That's from the sublime to the ridiculous. We're talking about sinking aircraft carriers, don't we?
Yes, but also I think it'd be quite useful to, I would very much like to, to see what your reaction was having gone to the pub. You may decide you only wanted to stay 5 minutes.
All right, well, I thought we were on international affairs.
We are. Yeah. We are on international affairs, but also we're talking about the sort of conversations that you might have down the pub, not be even being asked anywhere in the mainstream press about something as important as a Russian satellite.
Well, I mean, what's happened? Let's come back. Let's focus on China. Germany is definitely going to have Huawei to develop 5G. That's because it's competitive. Britain was going to have Huawei, but the Americans twisted
changed
our
arm. Their mind for maybe. I mean, the thing is, a lot can change in the next 8 years or so.
Well, indeed, and if the Nord Stream 2 pipeline goes ahead and Germany uses Huawei to develop its 5G, then they're going to outcompete Britain, aren't they? And jobs will be lost here, and they'll be gained in Germany. Is that in the British national interest? No, it isn't, but it keeps the Americans happy.
I wonder what you would react to, the way you'd react to what Manfred Petrich was saying there about the Balkans, saying effectively that this was a very important action that happened in the 1990s. What we saw was the fall of the Berlin Wall in 1989, and the big test was, okay, NATO has now lost its mission, but Yugoslavia in the Balkans is going to be a remissioned NATO in order to take over the Balkans, take over the former Yugoslavia and break it up, get rid of all those people that used to have communist leanings, to make it a part of NATO.
Well, as you know, Tony, I worked for the New Economics Foundation and for Catholic Funds of Overseas Development.
He was talking about Kosovo,
Eastern Europe.
Talking about the Balkan mafia moving in Kosovo.
And I went to Yugoslavia many times during the war. Clearly, there was a possibility with the fall of the Berlin Wall and the victory of, if you like, of liberalism in Eastern Europe, there was a possibility of a peace dividend, ending decades of conflict, trying to rebuild a peaceful continent. But of course, the military-industrial complex in the West was not interested in that outcome.
It's a little bit like the nuclear industry has got a massive momentum, a financial momentum of itself, and they don't want things like tidal power taking over from generating electricity around here. Even though we've got the highest tidal reach in the world in the Bristol Channel, or the equal highest tidal reach, Hinkley Power Station is going to be a nuclear station. We're not going to have a tidal power station, which would cost something like 10 times less to build and be far more sustainable, because you've got a massive financial momentum behind the nuclear industry. And what you're saying is there's an enormous financial momentum also behind the arms industry and NATO.
There is. I mean, it's fundamental. I mean, the problem with the war on terror was you don't actually need a lot of high-tech kit to fight it. But they, what they want to do, they've just passed through the Congress in the US a massive increase in military spending, and Bernie Sanders in the Senate tried to get 10% reduction on that, and it was all voted down. This is at a time when millions are unemployed. There's a major pandemic crisis and an economic crisis in the US. They've got more, they're spending more on the military now than they were at the height of the Cold War in the 1980s. And of course, this is because it's like a metastasizing cancer. Yeah. It's going to,
what does that mean?
Well, I mean, basically, the military industrial complex is a parasite on the economy and society. But of course, it's getting bigger and stronger all the time, and it'll eventually kill the society that is its host, unless something's done to stop it.
Killing the host. I think that's Michael Hudson's book about the financial system.
Yeah, that's right, the financial system. But I mean, both the financial system and the military-industrial complex are the two, evil forces that are mainly
at work. Is this driven by capitalism or is it ideology too?
It's both. There's capitalism has its own kind of internal dynamic. Even people who wanted to be good capitalists and not harm people are in competition with those who will. So there's a kind of competitive pressure in capitalism that always pushes towards the worst solution.
So it seems to me maybe capitalism is just a kind of cover story, really, for people's political agendas that they're rolling out through that game. Maybe kind of anarcho-capitalist.
Well, I think the interaction between the capitalist system and the political system is, you know, there's a massive literature on this and about what the actual, how it actually functions. I think capitalism, you know, there's some very good, you know, people like Immanuel Wallerstein and world systems theory and so on. Capitalism is a system which has passed its sell-by date and is metastasizing in front of us into something even more barbaric than it's been before.
And so the Great Reset is going to save us, apparently, as it all falls down.
Well, the point is that we're now going to go to the biggest crisis in the international system since 1945.
But some people
and
have
what
thought
will come
about
out of that is hard to predict.
Well, it's not, because some people have been thinking about this for a long time and they've already got a nice solution ready for us.
Well, everybody...
That is Davos, the World Economic Forum.
Yes, okay, but the billionaire class embedded in the banks and in the military-industrial complex, yes, they've got a strategy. But the problem for them is they haven't actually won any wars. The British Army were kicked out of Helmand Province and they were kicked out of Basra because they couldn't beat the local boys.
Anyway...
So they didn't win, did they?
I love Mantrik Petrish's stuff, and what I'll do, because there was only a short clip of the interview I did with him, so I'll put the full interview up on our show page at thisweek.org.uk and on Radio 4 All as well, so you can have a real listen to that if you want to listen to the whole thing, as well as the full interview with Mohsin Abbas Saeed as well this week. So I think that's the thing I should start doing. No use taking just a tiny clip. If you're interested in more on those, just go to our various web pages, mainly thisweek.org.uk, but also on Radio 4 All, and you'll find the longer interviews if you want to download and listen to the full interview. Lots more he had to say as well. But Martin, we're going to go on to quite a serious topic now, and that is the idea that for many, many years, the United States Pentagon has had a secret biowarfare program, and it was actually the Bulgarian investigative journalist Juliana Gaitancheva who in March 2018 popped up at the European Parliament, because one of the Pentagon's representatives was there. In fact, it was to do with biological research. And of course, this is quite a blurred area, isn't it, whether it's military or not?
Yeah, I mean, I think that we should be focusing on these biowarfare labs with laser-like intensity, because they claim that what they were doing in them is they're developing countermeasures against a biological warfare attack. Now, if that's what they were doing, then they haven't made a very good
job.
It's
a bit of a thin cover story, isn't it?
It is. And of course, what really is going on is they're developing biological weapons. That's what they're doing. And of course, they then accuse other countries of developing weapons of mass destruction, etc. That journalist, in fact, is very credible. She also uncovered the fact that Croatia was being used as a transshipment point for illegal weaponry, which ended up in the hands of ISIS and Al-Qaeda in Syria, and of course all paid for by the British taxpayer and the American taxpayer.
Anyway,
and that's what was going on. We were arming them all up.
Good old Diliana Gaitancheva from Bulgaria, and let's have a listen to her now in the European Parliament. This is way back in May, I believe it was May, wasn't it? Yes, March 2018.
Why has the Pentagon been operating military biolaboratories in 25 countries, bordering on the U.S. Main rivals, Russia, China and Iran? And why has deadly outbreaks in all those countries increased dramatically since the start of the military program of the United States in these countries?
I will just say unequivocally and undeniably, the U.S. does not have a military biological weapons program. Period. End of statement. We have been working, and I do know for the Department of Defense, they've been working with partners in parts of the world to ensure that those laboratories, and we train them on how to do diagnostic tests on these diseases, to ensure that they can manage them and also safely secure those pathogens so they're not accessible by terrorists or by criminals who would do ill with them.
while all these projects classified information, all these biolaboratories of the Pentagon in 25 countries across the world, why are they classified information?
They're not classified. They're openly available to anyone who wants to look at them.
No, I tried. No, this is not true. They're classified information.
No. You have a chance. It's not an investigation here. I'm very sorry.
What are you talking about?
But I will not let you.
Why can't
I will
talk
not
about
give you the word like this. We try to answer your questions, but that's not the place. Case closed. Thank you very much.
Well, that's quite interesting to hear the chairman of that European Parliament committee saying we're not here to do investigations, case closed. What she's saying there, Martin, is that in 25 countries that this classified Pentagon bioweapons program is operating, and she's proving what she's saying by explaining that this is classified. Now, obviously, if it's a research program which is civilian, it wouldn't be classified, but it is classified.
Indeed, and of course it's paid for by the Pentagon. Now, the Pentagon is not the health ministry, is it? If you were genuinely worried about the development of viruses like COVID-19, you would work in an open way with other countries to develop whatever techniques you needed to develop to try and deal with the problem. But in actual fact, what they've been doing and what they were doing in Wuhan, the virology laboratory, had funding from DARPA, which is the Pentagon's budget, which is extraordinary if you think about it. But I imagine what happened there is that the Chinese were told, well, let's work together with you to try and develop back coronaviruses. And of course, that allows the Americans the opportunity to seed it into China if they want to. And of course, what this journalist has also found out is that there's been outbreaks of all sorts of unexplained diseases in the hinterland of these labs. I think there's clearly an enormous amount of stuff going on here, which we're not hearing anything about. And they're deliberately, basically, obscuring what they're doing.
I mean, there was an extremely good, well-documented article. All the documents literally on there. It's an enormous page, but you have to do that in order to document and reference everything you're doing.
Yeah.
On the website armswatch.com, and this is an article from June last year, US diplomats involved in trafficking of human blood and pathogens for secret military program. That's by her, Diliana Gaitancheva. The US Embassy in Tbilisi transports frozen human blood and pathogens as diplomatic cargo for this secret US military program. Internal documents implicating US diplomats in transportation and experimenting on pathogens under diplomatic cover were leaked to me by Georgian insiders. That's her, the journalist. According to these documents, Pentagon scientists were deployed to the Republic of Georgia and have been given diplomatic immunity to research deadly diseases and biting insects at the Lugar Center, Pentagon's biolaboratory in Georgia's Tbilisi capital. So what? This Georgia seems to be playing quite an important role here.
Yeah, well, Georgia is, of course, we heard from Manfred earlier, and he's in Abkhazia, which broke away from Georgia. But Georgia, at one stage...
Yeah, Georgia's south of there, isn't it?
Yeah. Well, Abkhazia was at one point part of Georgia. But it's got a more Russian-speaking population. Georgia is where... Not Shevardnadze, what am I talking about? Shakashvili's from. And of course, Shakashvili is now back in the Ukraine, when he was booted out at one stage. And it was Shakashvili's people who probably flew from Georgia to carry out the assassinations of protesters in the Maidan Square in 2014, because there was a video linked to Georgia, and a couple of the guys that were involved admitted that they were the ones who'd killed the protesters. And of course, they're working closely with NATO intelligence services. Georgia is the Panjshir Valley there. There's all sorts of NATO stuff goes on there. And, it's because it used to be part of the Soviet Union. It's basically been carved out of Russia by Western interests. Georgia is a place of, a lot of the dodgy things go on in Georgia.
It was a war, wasn't there, in South Ossetia at the
right.
time of the... I seem to remember the war broke out exactly the same time as the Chinese Olympic Games were starting, right, during the opening ceremony. So the idea is the whole world's eyes from the mass media around the world were directed at China. Meanwhile, a war was starting in South Ossetia.
Yeah, well, of course, what happened with that was the Russians knew that there was going to be an attack, they waited until the Georgians attacked. And of course, Putin phoned up Netanyahu because the Georgians had been trained by 1,000 Israeli military personnel. And he said, when the war starts next week, you better make sure your people are out of there because we're going to kill them or capture them. So they all got on planes and flew back to Israel. Then the Georgian government tried to retake Abkhazia from the Russians. The Russians waited until they'd attacked, then counterattacked and basically thrashed them. And that was the end of that.
Yeah, geographically, how does that fit in? Because this all happened in August 2008.
Yeah, well, Georgia is in a strategic place, you know. I mean, all the time, if you're the Russian or the Chinese leaderships, you've got these kind of peripheral areas near to your country and sometimes inside your country.
Yeah, South Ossetia is a region of Georgia, isn't it, in the north?
Yeah.
Actually quite close to...
Abkhazia and South Ossetia were both regions of Georgia which broke away, a bit like what happened in Yugoslavia, which we were discussing earlier.
Yeah, so this is the front line, I guess, of Russia and NATO here in the...
So there's a question whether Georgia should join NATO, and the Germans aren't very happy about that.
In the Caucasus.
Yeah, because, you know, the Russians are going to say, well, you can't have... You know, we're not going to accept that, basically. So pressure points exist all over the world. And, any one of them can kick off at any one moment.
It's a sort of a bit of a grey area. You know what? It's a bit of a grey area, isn't it, Georgia? Because the government in there, the NATO, pro-NATO government in Georgia, relies heavily, because it's right next to the Russian border and Russian country's border, on a big US military backup presence in there. Therefore, that's the sort of thing that the Americans might decide, oh, well, this is a good place to use for cover, because the Georgians know we need to have loads of military personnel going in and out, and no questions asked.
That's right. It's basically a pro NATO puppet state. Now that's not quite fair, because I think in Georgia itself there has been some kind of kickback against this, and more pro NATO governments have fallen, and slightly less pro NATO governments have come through. But I mean, it's definitely regarded by the Brzezinskis of the West as part of their chessboard game with Russia.
Well, what about this military bioweapons program going on there, Martin? If this is what's happening under diplomatic cover, pathogens being smuggled backwards and forwards by in diplomatic bags, and potentially this is a program that shouldn't exist, isn't it?
Yeah, and I think because of what's happened with COVID, the issue about whether there should be biological warfare labs at all comes up, doesn't it? And she's done a very good job of showing, because they're scattered around all over the place. Yeah, they don't have them. They do have them inside the US. Fort Detrick is the main place for doing this, and of course that was closed down in June last year because there was some kind of leak from there, which may of course have been COVID-19.
Amazing that this investigative journalist Diliana Gutentsheva has done such amazing work on this. She's probably one of the most important in the world, and yet most Brits have never heard of her.
Yeah, well, she lost her job in Bulgaria for doing all of this work, but she is a very genuine investigative journalist, and she's got, as you say, there's a massive amount of references in her work, because if you're going to do that kind of investigative journalism, you can't just wave a hand and saying the spider web of fear in our society, like we heard from the doctors earlier. She's a journalist and she knows what she's doing.
I mean, this idea of saying, well, we are researching possible biological weapons defences, where actually you are preparing to attack using them, it really is only one word to describe that: evil.
It is potentially evil, yes. No doubt about it.
I mean, you're twisting the idea surely there should be just none of this going on at all.
Well, that's what the...
And if there is, then it needs to be stopped.
Yeah, well, I mean, in actual fact...
Hundreds of millions of people could die.
In actual fact, there is a convention against biological and chemical weapons. But you know what? The US hasn't ratified it. So they're not bound by it. And of course, they should be bound by it. There's no real basic... Biological weapons are inherently indiscriminate. There's absolutely no real reason to use them, and nobody should be developing them. But the US claims that they're not developing them, they're developing countermeasures against criminals and other evil elements might get their hands on this.
I mean, I know you don't agree with him, Martin, but we're going to hear Dr. Vernon Coleman, the author of the book, again, a second time tonight, maybe once next week. We had quite a lot of him last week, here, talking about the various... I mean, he believes it's evil. What's going on right now? Martin?
The confusion.
What's he believe? Biological warfare labs?
No, he believes that the measures which are being taken for a virus that he believes is now basically burnt out are also evil. The idea that you can't have political meetings, religious meetings, this sort of thing.
Well, it's a bit of a leap from biological warfare labs, but there we go.
The confusion, of course, is deliberate. The virus is known to affect the frail, the sick, and the chronically ill, but under the law... the elderly were kept prisoner, even though they might have been as fit as fiddles, whereas many of the frail, the sick and the chronically ill were all allowed to go out, as long as they didn't have a picnic or go bowling. We're being put under house arrest, for no logical reason, at the whim of the government, and kept there until we're allowed out. But when we are allowed out, we must keep our distance, and we must walk carefully and avoid the cracks in the pavement. We must wear masks if we go into a shop or a bank or a restaurant, but not if we go into an office. We should wear masks in our own homes, but only downstairs, because the virus doesn't like heights and won't go upstairs. If we go into a department store, we must wear masks on the ground floor and in the lifts, but not in the restaurant. And if there's one, or if there's a higher floor, we don't have to wear masks there. You can stay in a caravan as long as it's more than 18 feet long, and only two people at a time can travel in a car which is under 14 feet long. Swimmers must wear masks unless they're drowning. People must not share a mask unless they've been married for at least 5 years. In stores, the staff do not have to wear masks, but the customers must. But in restaurants, the staff must wear masks, but the customers don't have to. If someone goes into a takeaway wearing a mask, they must take their food outside to eat it. But if they enter not wearing a mask, then they can eat food while sitting at a table. We mustn't talk to friends, sing, or do anything that looks like fun. We can play tennis or cricket with one friend as long as the ball we use is wiped with a disinfectant wipe for 30 seconds every time it is handled. If we are professional sports persons, we can play our sport as long as no one watches us. We can enter a place of worship if it's open, as long as we wear a mask and maintain social distancing. But there will be no services, no public worshipping, and definitely no singing. We can go into a pub as long as we sit quietly and order our drinks by using our mobile phones, sit quietly at our table and give all our personal details to the person at the door. We can't play pool, darts or dominoes or take part in quizzes. There can be no live music, and we must not approach the bar at any time or for any reason. We can leave our table only to visit the loo, and then only after the loo has been thoroughly cleaned and sanitized. We can have our hair cut and our nails polished, but hospital physiotherapy departments are still closed. We can visit a dentist if we can find one which is open, but we can't have our teeth filled, so anything aching or painful must be removed. We can go out into the streets to demonstrate for or against politically acceptable views, but we can't go out into the streets to demonstrate for or against the laws which prevent us going out into the streets and leaving our homes. Social distancing laws and laws about wearing masks can be ignored. If we are protesting about issues which have been endorsed by left-wing politicians, but not if we're protesting or campaigning about issues which have been endorsed by right-wing politicians. We can't have picnics with friends or relatives if the picnics are held on a beach, in the park, or in our own gardens. But we may eat by ourselves in our own homes, though we may not go shopping to buy food unless we wear masks. We can jog in a park, but we can't sit on a bench to rest if we're tired. We can have sex indoors with a professional sex worker, but if we have sex with a fiancé, we must make sure we do it under a blanket in the garden. Nothing makes any sense anymore. We're constantly being warned that there is worse to come. The coronavirus is about to mutate. When it does, then it will become far more dangerous. A completely new virus is about to leap from pigs or bats or some other mythical creature, and it will kill millions, hundreds or possibly billions. Those who've had the virus do not have permanent immunity, and so regular vaccinations will be essential. Next winter's flu is going to be worse than usual. They've said there's going to be much flooding, and no doubt when the floods go down, there'll be massive fires. And all this is our fault, because we put up too many statues to the wrong sort of people. We are paying our government and our civil servants to terrorise us. In the thrall of Satan, they and their acolytes are everywhere. Our world is upside down, and it's impossible to guess what will come next. But meanwhile, you and I must continue to aggravate the traitors and the collaborators. It's a war, and we are the resistance.
Well, that's Dr. Vernon Coleman speaking again this week, Martin. Now, I mean, he's having a bit of fun with us there, in that he's going through lots of things, some of which might be and some of which might not be true. But I think it's fair to play that, because the point he's making is that it's really, he's saying essentially, you know, nothing makes sense. That it seems that there's deliberate confusion, the point he starts off with.
Well, in that case, we should try and make sense of it, isn't it? And make sensible criticisms where they're justified, and not mix various things up, as he does. I mean, basically, he's an entertainer, rather than a political analyst.
His point is not that he is making them up, is that the government is making them up, and that we are being told all sorts of mixed messages by the media and the government.
That's right. Well, there's an awful lot of confusion out there, as we know.
But is it real confusion, or is it deliberate confusion?
There's a question about whether it's deliberate, but of course, if it's deliberate, there's been a biological weapons attack on China, which the Chinese Communist Party have beaten back.
I'm talking about the information that we're getting.
But not
the actual virus itself.
Well, but the information, it looks to me like the British government are majorly incompetent.
So this is not deliberate, then? There's just an accident.
No, it's not. It may be deliberate. It may be a biological warfare attack on China by the deep state in the US. Boris Johnson isn't in on it. Boris Johnson don't know much, and he certainly don't know much about that.
So the disinformation is also deliberate. Is that what you're saying?
No, the disinformation...
It's just an accident.
The disinformation in Britain is because we've got a load of chumps in charge who can't make up their mind from one minute to the next.
I would disagree with you on that one, because I think it's deliberate. We're being told all sorts of mixed messages in order to really convince us to disengage and actually to instill fear. That's the key thing.
Well, the biological warfare attack on China was to instill fear in China and elsewhere, but the Chinese got on top of it. And as we go into World War III now, the Chinese military, for example, are free of COVID. The aircraft carriers, which were coming their way, they've had to park them in loads of places further away because they've got loads of COVID on their aircraft carriers. And, of course, the aircraft carriers themselves can be shot down by the missiles that the Chinese have got. Now, when this all kicks in, people will realise that COVID-19 was deliberate, and the whole thing is deliberate, and it is about confusion. But it's not about confusion about face masks, Tony.
So the censorship coming into the open, we were hearing about earlier, quite a lot about it actually, but our basic ideas like creation or intelligence design also been censored over the decades. We're going to have a listen now to the author of Tornado in a Junkyard, the guy called James Perloff, and his quote, Tornado in a Junkyard, is something that comes from a British author, actually, talking about the idea of humanity and life itself coming out randomly through evolution is about as likely as a tornado in a junkyard. So that's an interesting view, which we haven't really had expressed very well. So let's have a listen now to the question, has the spiritual also been the target over decades of a long psychological warfare operation? We're going to hear now from James Perloff.
We're going to present four proofs that it's wrong, and then I'm going to take two proofs that the evolutionists use and show where they're flawed. And I think the best place to start is at the beginning of life. Sean, I want you to put a graphic up on the screen, because I think it's important we give our audience a one-minute refresher on what the theory of evolution says.
Can do.
What the theory says is that life began in the ocean, billions of years ago, when the right chemicals formed our single-celled ancestors by chance. And then these single-celled creatures began to evolve into multicellular creatures, and they became the first seagoing invertebrates, invertebrates, a creature without a backbone like a jellyfish. Then the invertebrates evolved into fish, and then fish yearned to come ashore, and so their fins started to evolve into legs, and they became the first amphibians, which are creatures, of course, that can go on land or water like a frog. And then amphibians evolved into reptiles, reptiles evolved into mammals, and then eventually within the class of mammals, you had these ape-like creatures who evolved into man. And that's the theory in a nutshell. It might be taught a little differently from one school of thought to another, but that's it. And that's basically what your kids are taught in school. So to start at the beginning, the origin of life, and Darwin did talk about that, the origin of species, said that life began in a warm little pond, but after a while they realized that a pond wouldn't last long enough for significant evolution to take place, so they changed it to the ocean. So let's see what's wrong with this. Now, I've got a can here of all-natural cola, and if we look at it, it says cola. It says 12 ounces, which it reminds us, in this case, is 354 mls. It says Whole Foods on it, and it's got a list of ingredients, the amount of fat and sodium, and it's got a barcode, which is scannable, and it's got a pop top, which works very nicely, and it's got cola inside, very tasty, right? Now, does anybody think that this can and its contents and the printing on the outside could have originated by pure chance? And obviously not. I mean, it's too well designed. So that raises the question of how could a cell come about by chance, because it's astronomically more complex than the can I just showed you. And I want to give you a quote. The quote is this, quote, "A simple one-celled bacterium, or a coli, contains DNA information units that are the equivalent of 100 million pages of Encyclopedia Britannica," unquote. And that quote is from the Encyclopedia Britannica. Now, cells have a functional unit called proteins. That's their basic unit. And even in a bacterial cell, there's thousands of different proteins. And not to get technical, but proteins are found down in a smaller building block called amino acids, and there's hundreds in one protein, and they have to be in the right order. And some of your listeners, I'm sure, have heard of Francis Crick. He won the Nobel Prize for co-discovering the structure of DNA. And he calculated what the odds would be of getting a protein by chance, you know, NaH in ocean. You know what the odds are, according to Francis Crick? The odds are 1 in 10 to the power of 260. And if you want to know how big a number that is, you couldn't fit that many electrons in the known universe. Mathematicians usually say that anything with odds greater than 1 in 10 to the power of 50 is impossible. So it would be impossible to get one protein by chance, let alone the thousands a cell would need. And think about it. A cell would need the ability to ingest nutrients, expel waste. And really think about this one. This first cell formed by chance before it died in the span of one lifetime would have had to develop and perfect the process of cellular reproduction, because if it didn't, there never would have been a second cell, and Darwin's evolutionary process would stop right there.
Can you tell people about Tornado in a Junkyard?
Well, that's the title of my first book on Darwinism, and I borrowed the imagery from Sir Fred Hoyle, the noted British astronomer. He was asked what he thought the chances were of higher life forms evolving by Darwinian processes, and he said that the odds would be the same as a tornado sweeping through a junkyard and leaving behind a perfectly assembled Boeing 747. Yeah. And I love that imagery, so I chose it for the title of my book. So we're talking about science. Science is based on observations, and there are no observations to support this idea that a cell could come about by chance. I mean, nobody's ever seen chemicals randomly assemble themselves into working functional cellular parts. Okay. But our second of four evidences is genetics. And, of course, genes dictate what our, physical makeup is. Now, a zebra can't give birth to a baby kangaroo. Why? Because she hasn't got kangaroo genes. A woman can't even be born with blonde hair unless she's got genes for blonde hair, right? Otherwise, she's got to use Lady Clairol. Now, Darwin didn't know about genetics. As we're saying, science is advancing. It was not a science in his day, at least when he wrote The Origin of Species. And when Darwinists first heard of genetics, when they learned about it, they first resisted it. And the reason was they realized, you know, we don't have to just explain in our theory how the anatomical features came about by evolution. We now have to explain how the new genes came about, because, you know, if we came from a fish, you know, a fish's gene pool is radically different than a human's gene pool. So where the genes come from? And this originally stumped the Darwinists, but they came up with a solution. And what the solution was, Sean, it was mutations. random mutations, which are a copying mistake in the genetic code. They occur very rarely, but they do occasionally happen, and they do change genetic information,
well,
right?
Cancer is a mutation, too.
Yeah.
There's a definite downside to some mutations, James.
I'll say. they say that mutations are the building block of evolutionary change. So in other words, you know, hundreds of millions of years ago, some fish got a random mutation that gave a little bit of an arm, right? And this was conferred such a great survival advantage that it spread through those fish. And then lo and behold, another mutation came along, which gave it a little bit more of an arm until finally the fish had, through mutation, developed an arm. Okay. Here's the problem with that. As science is advancing, as you said, we now have this book, Not by Chance, Shattering the Modern Theory of Evolution by Dr. Lee Spetner, who is no dweeb. Maybe I didn't hold that up in a way you can really see it. But Dr. Spetner, MIT grad, PhD, taught information science for years at Johns Hopkins University and the Weizmann Institute. And here's what he writes in his book. Quote, "In all the reading I've done in life sciences literature, I've never found a mutation that added information. All point mutations that have been studied on the molecular level turn out to reduce the genetic information and not increase it."
Yeah.
Unquote. So what he's saying here is mutations... I'm sorry.
They're destructive. Mutations can be destructive.
They are almost universally destructive. They always destroy function. They never add it. Right. They always reduce information, never increase it. Now, just again, science is based on observation. So what do we observe mutations do to human beings? They give you sickle cell anemia, cystic fibrosis, Down syndrome, hemophilia, and about 4,000 other genetic diseases. They never improve us, yet they're supposed to be the building blocks of evolutionary improvement, right? And now, I want you to put another graphic up on the screen for our viewers, because evolutionists will object at this point and say that there are such a things as beneficial mutations. And the one I want you to put up is the one called sickle cell anemia. Now, I've been on radio and had an evolutionist call up and say, sickle cell anemia, and this is a common argument, by the way, sickle cell anemia is a wonderful example of how mutations create evolution. Now, why do they say this? What's the benefit of sickle cell anemia? Because it's a disease. Well, the benefit is that people with sickle cell do not get malaria. And so the argument is that mutations have redesigned, reconstructed the red blood cells so we don't get malaria. Okay, so let's look at the picture. And we see a normal red blood cell, and below that a sickle cell. Now, the sickle cell is deformed. It is misshapen. The function of red blood cells is to transport oxygen. It's lost function. It does not transport oxygen as well as a normal cell. It clogs your arteries. It causes intense pain. And I used to work with sickle cell victims back in the 70s. And back then, before medical advances, it was common for people to die in their 20s from this disease. Nobody hopes that their child will get sickle cell anemia because it prevents malaria. Now, it's true that the parasites that cause malaria don't like to go into these deformed cells, but that's just like you wouldn't want to move into a house that was all dilapidated, you know? It has lost function. It has lost information. You know what, Sean? If I cut off my legs, I won't get athlete's foot. It'll prevent a disease, right? So that's a benefit, right? But it's not evolution. All mutations will delete information and function. They don't add to it. That's Dr. Spetner's point, and that is our proof number two. We see these organisms, right? We see these microorganisms, invertebrates, fish, to amphibians, to reptiles, to mammals. That's a sequence that Darwin proposed and which is still taught in public schools today. All right. So if we look at these pictures, Sean, there are tens of thousands of species that fit into these categories, germs, invertebrates, fish, amphibians, reptiles, and mammals. But how many species are there that are intermediate? Zero. Not one. Nada. But there should be many. Darwin said the number would be inconceivably great. In fact, I'm going to ask you to put another picture up, which is a microcosm of this picture. It's called fish to amphibian. Now, to think about it, for a fish to become a walking land creature, it wouldn't have to just evolve new bones. It would have to evolve new muscles to support those bones and new nerves to control the movements of the limbs. And while it was coming on shore, it would have to evolve a whole new breathing system. Now, according to evolutionists themselves, this happened by chance mutations. So as you can imagine, in the red arrow area here, the in-between phase, there would have to be millions of creatures living and dying. And as I said, Darwin himself called said the number would be inconceivably great. So where are they? Why is it that we have no overlaps? The founder of taxonomy, Carolus Linnaeus, he's the guy who started calling creatures by genus, species. He invented those terms, right? He was against evolution because he saw there were no overlaps. So how did Darwinists explain this? Here's how they explain it. All the intermediate transitional forms became extinct.
Well, that's convenient.
Okay. Well, you know, that's like saying that my dog ate my homework.
Yeah.
The translation of they all became extinct is we ain't got no proof. It just says there's no proof for a cell coming out by chance. If you can put on that the screen one more time, this is the last time I'll ask for it, that evolution sequence from microorganism to human. This is what I want to say. We started out as basically a bacterium, a single-celled creature who evolved into a human. But did you know, Sean, science is based on observation, right? Did you know by actual observation, we've never seen one species of bacteria evolve into another species of bacteria? This is a quote from Alan H. Litton, Professor Emeritus of Bacteriology at the University of Bristol in England. Quote, throughout 150 years of the science of bacteriology, there is no evidence that one species of bacteria has changed into another. Hmm. Unquote. How do you like them apples? We're supposed to believe bacteria became people, but by actual observation, no species of bacteria has even changed to another species of bacteria. Okay, since there are no transitional or in-between forms in the living world, the evolutionists will say it's in the fossil record, and you had asked about that. Let's just touch on that. In my books, I have quotes from evolutionists themselves that there are no transitional forms between any of these major groups, but we haven't got time for that, so I'm going to give you one coverall quote. And this is from Colin Patterson, senior paleontologist at the British Museum of Natural History. In fact, he was the director of the British Museum. Quote, the American Museum people are hard to contradict when they say there are no transitional fossils. As a paleontologist myself, I am much occupied with the philosophical problems of identifying ancestral forms in the fossil record. I will lay it on the line. There is not one such fossil for which one could make a watertight argument, unquote, Colin Patterson. You'll find the quotes and citations in my books. Let's take a couple examples of, because you will see, evolution will argue against this, of course, because every once in a while you will see a spectacular headline saying a missing link's been found. Let's take two examples of missing links, okay, that have been discredited. Put the picture up of Piltdown Man.
Right.
Now,
complete fraud.
Yeah. Here we have the Piltdown Man surrounded by scientists. The guy in the white suit is Sir Arthur Keith, noted anatomist. And looking over his shoulder is Sir Grafton Elliott Smith, and you have these other Darwinists. By the way, the reason they're called Sir is because they were knighted for their work on the Piltdown Man.
They serve the Queen.
They're still doing it, right? Still serving the different queens.
Many people do.
Anyway, what was the Piltdown Man? The Piltdown Man was an alleged ape man found in a gravel pit not too far from Darwin's home. And it consisted of a jawbone and a skull. And when the find was announced in 1912, you know what the headline was in the New York Times? It was Darwin Theory Proved True.
Right.
Oh, you can always rely on good old mainstream media, you know.
Hearst, that was probably a Hearst publication. Hearst himself wrote that one.
He would have. I think the New York Times beat him to the punch. He was over on the New York Journal, right? But anyway, okay, so this alleged ape man, which they said was 500 million years old, was on display at the British Museum for about 40 years before it was discovered to be a fake. What it actually was not 500 million years old. The lower jawbone was a modern orangutan jaw. Somebody had simply filed down the teeth to make them more human-looking and stained it to make it look old. And they put it together in the pit with a human skull, which they also stained to make it look old. And it fooled all these guys at the British Museum, although, who knows, maybe one or two were even involved with the fraud. Who knows? But some people would say, okay, well, that was a clever forgery. You know, anyone could be fooled by a forgery, but no one could be fooled by a real fossil. So let's take an example of how you can be fooled by a real fossil. So I'd like you to put on the screen the image I've called coelacanth fossil. And what we're looking at is the coelacanth was a fish found in Jurassic Rock, the age of the dinosaurs. And for years, evolutionists said it had been extinct for tens of millions of years. And they said it was a transition between fish and amphibians. And if you look at this fossil, it looks like it's walking, right? They said this is a walking fish. Look, it's got little legs there. Here's the problem. In 1938, somebody caught a live coelacanth off the coast of Madagascar. And since then, hundreds more have been caught. And if you could put the image now on the screen of live coelacanth, examination of the coelacanth proved it was 100% fish, no amphibian characteristics. Now, why is it so easy to be fooled by a fossil? Because 99% of the biology of any creature is in its soft anatomy, which you cannot access on a fossil. And that makes it very easy to fill in the other 99%, fill in besides the 1% you can see with your imagination. And that's fossils. You'll see an occasional spectacular one announced, but there should be an inconceivably great number of these fossils if the theory is true. And, of course, we don't see those. All right, the fourth area of evidence that I'd like to address today comes from Dr. Michael Behe, who's a biochemist at Lehigh University in Pennsylvania. He's written this book, Darwin's Black Box, The Biochemical Challenge to Evolution. And in this book, he talks about something called irreducible complexity. Now, what he means by that is that in the human body and other creatures, there are certain systems that are very complex and that consist of interdependent parts. You take away one or two parts, the whole system won't work. Ergo, they cannot have evolved. Now, that sounds abstract, so let's take a practical example that he gives. If we get a cut and we bleed, the body stops that with a blood clot. Now, blood clot might look simple to the naked eye, but it's actually a very complex process. Sean, if you could put up on the screen what I called a blood clotting cascade. It's well over a dozen steps to make a blood clot. And a person with hemophilia, which is a disease caused by mutation, is missing factor 8, which I've circled there. And they're at high risk for bleeding. Now, if you were missing 2 or 3 factors in the blood clotting process, no chance for survival. You'll bleed to death. So here's the question Dr. Behe asked. How could evolution have produced this? Because in the Darwinian model, blood clotting would have evolved over eons as random mutations introduced each step of the process. But that doesn't work. 3 steps won't do you any good. 6 won't do you any good. Or 9. If you've only got 9 steps of the blood clotting process, you'll bleed to death. And if you bleed to death, you can't pass on the incremental stages to the next generation. And so the point that Dr. Behe makes is that this whole system had to be in place from the very beginning, which would indicate an intelligent designer. Now, he goes on, he shows the same thing with human vision. You know, what came first? Was it the retina, the optic nerve? They've all got to be there. Same thing with the immune system. What came first? Antibodies, white blood cells, they all have to be working together. So Dr. B is not a Bible thumper, but his point is that there are systems which evolution cannot explain. That's our fourth and last evidence against evolution.
So that's James Perloff there. He's the author of Tornado in a Junkyard, really putting 4 pretty strong cases, Martin, against the evolution as against intelligent design. What do you make of that?
Well, it was very long. There is, of course, a massive dispute about this. Intelligent design is an ascent. It's interesting that there's various versions of intelligent design. Intelligent design could be that the first amoeba was, created by God, and then everything flows from that. And in actual
maybe an alien.
Well, yeah, it could be. I mean, you know, it's possible that we're
but who created the alien?
Yeah, well, indeed. So, in other words, but these are the philosophical questions. Yeah. So, in other words,
you're a philosopher.
It's quite possible. You can logically believe in God and that God created evolution. And I would argue that that's the mainstream view in the Christian churches today. And I think the idea of intelligent design, people need to read Daniel Dennett and Consciousness Explained, a very good book. And he explains how in actual fact, in all systems, and this is chaos theory, simple, you start off with very simple rules. And eventually complexity flows automatically out of very simple systems. And he shows how it works in Daisy World, in computers, and it also works in the real world.
So he's saying bacteria can make humans?
Well, in actual fact, nothing was mentioned there about DNA. Now, DNA analysis of modern humans shows that we've got some Neanderthal genes, we've got some Denisovian genes.
Well, there was quite a lot said about genetics, actually.
Well, no, but I mean, there's nothing about DNA, though.
Particularly about, well, mutation of DNA.
Yes, I know, but,
he's saying that all it does is destroy function when you get a mutation.
Mutation is basically neutral. The sickle cell anemia has developed. I'm not an expert. I'm not trying to argue with experts, but of sickle cell anemia, but basically people in Africa developed immunity to malaria. Because, of course, the people who didn't have immunity to malaria, they died, and they didn't have any kids. And the ones who did have immunity to malaria, they survived. And the sickle cell is part of that. Now, in other words, it's got a two-edged sword to it. Now, the idea that all mutations are remove function rather than create function, ultimately, the theory of evolution is based on the idea, it's based on luck, really. It's just based on luck. And of course, when the asteroid hit the Yucatan Peninsula, all the dinosaurs were absolutely adapted to their environment and have been adapted for millions of years. Suddenly the environment changed and the adaptation means nothing.
It could also be that the human beings killed dinosaurs off because they didn't find them very nice.
Well, there weren't any human beings when dinosaurs were around, Tony. That's according to mainstream scientific thinking.
Okay.
Now, of course, one of the problems we've got is when we ask questions about biological warfare.
But mainstream scientific thinking is telling us that that the first cell, it would be quite easy for that to evolve into the second cell. But James Perloff's pointing out there, it's a miracle to just create cell number one. And it's almost impossible to imagine that that would also enable, in its own DNA, that cell to be able to reproduce at the same time as creating it for the first time. And these are pretty powerful arguments.
Well, no, because in actual fact, it could have happened loads and loads of time, and the first cell died every time. Until, on the millionth time, or the billionth time, because there's lots and lots of cells, one of them managed it. And patently, they did, because otherwise we wouldn't be here at all, would we?
Well, he's saying is that that's a very strong argument for intelligent design rather than evolution.
Yeah, but I mean, I think you'll find that in biology departments, intelligent design is regarded as cranky, Tony. Now, can I just come back to the point about biological warfare labs and the stuff
yes,
we normally
in,
go around the politics?
On, because in finance departments, much of what we talk about the global financial system being a total disaster and about to collapse, is also believed to be cranky, and that actually the financial system is self-regulating, and we know it's not.
Let's put it this way, Tony. Just because there are things out there which are being manipulated, yeah? So 9/11 was an inside job. But that doesn't mean it was carried out by aliens, does it?
What about intermediate species? We were just talking about there, no evidence of it at all, and no examples of it either. No fossil, nothing in the fossil record.
Well, there's loads of fossil records about human beings. That's what I know quite a lot about. I read a lot of anthropology. We definitely evolved from Lucy's people. We've all got mitochondrial DNA that goes back to Easter.
So have we got a trail of all the different sorts of humans evolving from apes
the
centuries?
It's in our physical DNA. They thought that Neanderthals completely died out. And then they found some DNA in Neanderthal teeth in Croatia, and then they tested modern humans, and no, not all Neanderthals died out. Some of us have some Neanderthal genes.
Okay, so
genes.
You think the Darwinian model stands up still?
I'm afraid I do, Tony.
Okay.
Sorry.
Interesting. That's all for this week. You've been listening to the Not the BCFM Politics Show with Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers and me, Tony Gosling. Thanks for our guest. That is Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers. You can download our MP3s and you can listen in the car or anywhere you like. You'll find this show's podcast, story links, comment page and our contact details at thisweekoneword.org.uk. I'm on Twitter at Tony Gosling. Have a relaxing and enjoyable weekend. Sunday evenings at 7 or even 6 with Danny Lopsch on BCFM. Our boss Pat Hart at BCFM. Still, we haven't really heard from him if we're going to be coming back. We do hope we may be back in November. We shall see. Do please join us for the Politics Show live stream, 5 o'clock next Friday. God bless. And don't let the banksters get you down.
love of God!
Do you ever have days when you feel as though you got out of bed on the wrong planet? This is one of those, I think. Prudens Futuri, and that's called In the Name of the One.